Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I heard people talk about anger on the Saturday program, and I was just thinking about that incident. And what I've been doing since that day is listening to specific music like Fela Kuti, Bob Marley. I might listen to old programs of Dr. Weldon, Neely Fuller, The Cows. And also, I've been listening to motivational speakers. I think one is called one of the guys is Eric Thomas, a black guy, and another guy, a black guy, is Les Brown. And that's been helping me out a lot. Like they still make like jungle noises and do weird things, but everything that I've been doing, and then along with working out, thanks to Emmy, I started working out again.
We know that exercise benefits health. Kind of obvious, and we're learning more about that. Researchers find people who exercise regularly throughout their lifetimes may be able to keep their hearts and muscles decades younger. NPR's Patty Naiman reports on the study published in the Journal of Applied Physiology.
It started in the 70s. Running, aerobics, an exercise boon that produced today's 70-somethings who've exercised most of their adult life, like 74-year-old Susan McGrath, a retired nurse practitioner who started running as a young mother.
And have spent about 45 years running. I still run.
It's addictive, she says, because no matter how the day goes, she can always run and feel better.
I ran today, actually. There was little snowflakes coming down and was down by the river, and it's just wonderful. I think it's also become more of a contemplative, meditative process for me.
And it turns out an important boost for her physical health as well. McGrath was part of a study at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana, headed by exercise physiologist Scott Trappi, who divided 70 people into three groups, those in their mid-70s who exercised on average for over 52 years, those in their mid-70s who didn't do structured exercise, and those in their mid-20s who did. Trappi compared the three groups with the goal of answering these questions.
One, what was their cardiovascular health? Number two, what was their skeletal muscle health?
To measure cardiovascular health, all participants cycled on a stationary bike for increasingly challenging sessions and exhaled into a mouthpiece that measured oxygen levels, an indicator of cardiovascular strength.
Lifelong exercisers did very well. Their cardiovascular system looked more like that of 40 to 45-year-olds.
And when it came to muscles, the news was even better.
Well, if I showed you the muscle data that we have, you wouldn't know that it was from an older individual.
Because it looks more like the muscles of a 25-year-old. Trappi took pea-sized biopsies of muscles and examined capillaries that produce blood flow and a number of enzymes.
The capillaries and enzymes we're talking about were maintained relative to the young individuals, so it looks like full preservation with the lifelong exercise.
So Trappi says if you want to maintain health in later years, exercise routinely. Walking 30 to 45 minutes most days of the week can be highly beneficial. Hattie Naiman, NPR News.
Why haven't you learned anything?
High school students in Seattle appear to have benefited from the shift to a later school start time. New research from the University of Washington shows the teens got more sleep and better grades after the switch. KNKX Youth and Education reporter Ashley Gross has the story.
The Seattle School District made the change 2 years ago. It was in response to research that shows that adolescents undergo a physical shift in their sleep habits.
This is a biological phenomenon. There's not much they can do about it. You can tell them as much as you want to go to bed at 10 p.m., but they won't fall asleep until midnight at least.
Horacio de la Iglesia is a biology professor at UW. He and the other researchers asked teens to wear wrist monitors to track activity levels. That's how they were able to calculate how long students slept. They found that the teens gained about 34 minutes of sleep per night, and their grades improved 4.5%. De la Iglesia says they can't conclude more sleep caused students to get better grades.
But we know there's tons of literature showing that indeed sleeping better leads to better learning and better performance.
The study appeared in the journal Science Advances. Ashley Gross, KNKX News.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
King County restaurants display smiley or grim face signs to show their health inspection ratings. That's not yet required, though, for school cafeterias. But taking a look at the county's health department, the data shows 12 Seattle public schools received unsatisfactory ratings for their latest inspections. KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld has the story.
For parents, the most concerning thing about school lunch is probably which foods kids put on their trays. Like this lunch tray at Robert Eagle Staff Middle School.
All right, so we got some like a pita and some pizza and like a chocolate milk.
When health inspectors visit school cafeterias, they're more worried about how that food was prepared and handled. The cafeterias in Seattle Public Schools feed children about 4 million meals and snacks each year. County health departments examine school kitchens twice a year to make sure they're up to code.
Typically, we see great scores and great results from schools in regards to food safety inspections.
Leanne Echo directs Child Nutrition Services for the State Education Department. She says statewide, cafeteria workers are typically highly trained, and there are multiple levels of oversight.
There's kind of always a standing joke about how it's the cleanest and the safest place to eat in a community.
The King County Health Department website shows that in the Highline School District, just south of Seattle, there were no recent critical violations. But KUOW found that in Seattle Public Schools, it was a different story. Cafeterias at 12 schools had unsatisfactory ratings on their latest inspections. They had red critical violations, like food at unsafe temperatures, workers without the proper training or food handling permits, and faulty hand-washing stations. Iyab Mazengia with Public Health Seattle and King County is scrolling through those cafeteria inspection reports.
Do not serve pizza and ravioli that have been in walk-in since at least yesterday.
He says day-old pizza and ravioli are theoretically healthy, but not if they're stored in a warm refrigerator. At this elementary school, part of the walk-in fridge was 50 degrees.
And maximum temperature allowed in a cold-holding unit is 41.
Mazengia says that's the kind of violation that gets a kitchen an unsatisfactory rating. Seattle Public Schools turned down requests for an interview for this story, but said in a written statement that the infractions identified by the health department are, for the most part, routine infractions that any food service establishment experiences. The infractions at SPS occur at a pace that is common to all food service establishments, and the infractions at SPS are always promptly corrected. Still, KUOW found that some schools have had repeated unsatisfactory ratings for years. Lowell and West Seattle elementary schools have had violations on most of their last 10 inspections. So did the central kitchen at district headquarters that prepares most of the food served at schools.
I'm surprised at what you shared about what you found in the Seattle area. It's a little disturbing to hear that.
Leanne Echo with the State Education Department says while there haven't been any foodborne illnesses traced to local K-12 cafeterias in recent years, an outbreak could be serious.
Because with any kind of foodborne illness, we know that it has a larger effect on young kids.
And low-income kids would be the most likely children affected. They eat 3/4 of the meals served in Seattle public schools. King County is expected to require schools to display the same smiley face signs as restaurants, but there's no timeline yet. In the meantime, University of Washington food safety lecturer Charles Easterberg says families should do their own research.
The first thing they should do is look at the inspection report at the health department website.
If they see health code violations, he says,
they can go to the school and ask for elaboration, and they can also call the health department and they can ask for them to interpret. Then the last thing they do is say, okay, what has been done about it and what is going to be done about it?
In Seattle, I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
Black babies cost less.
By now you may have seen the videos circulating on Facebook and elsewhere of NYPD officers forcibly removing a small child from his mother as they attempted to arrest her. In an ironic twist of fate, the mother, 23-year-old Jasmine Headley, was at an assistance center to pick up daycare vouchers for her young son when she was approached by officers, apparently for sitting on the floor when there were no seats, and then refusing to get up. Headley was arrested on multiple charges and is now being held without bail at Rikers. Her child was placed with relatives for now by the Administration for Children's Services. We've talked on the show before about how certain vulnerable parents, including parents of color in many cases, are disproportionately more likely to be separated from their children by ACS. In this case, the NYPD claims that the mother was acting disorderly. But when is separation allowable by law or right? Joining me to discuss are Nikita Stewart, New York Times Metro reporter covering social services, and Harrison DiPrinzio, reporter at City Limits. We'll also talk about larger ACS issues, including when the NYPD gets involved with kids who run away from foster care and problems within the foster care system. So welcome back, Nikita and Harry, to WNYC.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Nikita, you contributed to the initial reporting for the Times of the incident. Why was the NYPD called on this mother in the first place? Is it clear?
Right now there are security officers who have been placed on leave, and when they return, they will be placed on modified duty because they chose to call the police instead of handling the situation with Ms. Headley. The Commissioner of Social Services has already announced that there will be some retraining to de-escalate before calling the police and getting them involved. But we see this with lots of different social service agencies, with security officers going ahead and calling the police.
So lots of cases. You've covered social services extensively. Is something like this now in the public conversation as a matter of outrage because this video got out? Is this in any way a common experience for parents seeking help with childcare?
For seeking child care, I'm not so sure if we can get that specific, but we can definitely talk about going to different social service agencies. And, tensions are high. People have been waiting for hours and hours and hours. If you look at the perspective of social workers and caseworkers and people working in the office, intake workers, they'll say that they are overworked and, many times words are exchanged. The same thing with the security officers who, remember, are not paid very much and are often one step away from being in the same situation or actually are in the same situation. In Ms. Headley's case, in fact, I believe her mother works as a security officer.
Here we are. I'm going to go right to a phone call because I see that apparently Jasmine Headley's lawyer is calling in. So this is Lisa from Brooklyn Defender Services. Lisa, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
Thanks, Brian.
How's your client?
Well, what's really interesting is that she has no idea about the national outrage that's been happening. She's in Rikers Island and doesn't have access to social media or anything. So one of our social workers at Brooklyn Defender Services went out yesterday to talk to her, and I spoke to her this morning, and she has no idea at all that she's become the face of this issue. And really, our goal is to try to get her out of Rikers, which we're going to try today. And she's really struggling. She said it was the worst thing that ever happened to her in her life. And if you saw the video, I'm sure we would all agree that must have been a horrifying experience.
This incident took place on Friday. Today's Tuesday. Why is she still in Rikers?
Well, it's kind of a little complicated, but what happened was when she was 20 years old, which was 2 years ago, she got arrested in New Jersey in a case where she was with four people in a car, and they pulled the car over, and they found, it sounds like they found some stolen credit cards, but they let her go. And now she was in Trenton, New Jersey. She's a Brooklyn person, doesn't have any experience in New Jersey, and honestly really didn't even know how to get back there, what to do. So because of that, there was a warrant issued in that case. When she was picked up on this case with the allegations of disorderly conduct, and they also, by the way, charged her with endangering the welfare of a child, which is really absurd, but those are the charges. When she comes to court, they then find that there's this warrant out. Because it's out of state, they have to file an extradition proceeding, if you can believe that. And that is what's holding her right now. We are working very aggressively to try to get her out today, if we can.
How old is her child?
Her child is about one.
And where is that baby?
Baby is with her mother, so the child's grandmother, who correctly, you know, was stated she is a security guard. Actually, I think it's CNN. And she has to actually give the child to the great-grandmother of the child today so that the grandmother can go to work.
Wow. And do you think that Jasmine Headley is going to have to demonstrate with whatever else on these credit card charges or any of that stuff, is she going to have to demonstrate as a result of this incident in some way to the court that she's a fit mother to get her baby back?
Well, I'm very concerned about that. I would say, I know this segment is about ACS, and I would really, you know, just like to say that I certainly hope not, because this is on video. I hope that does not happen. But I would say if this wasn't on video, there is very little question that ACS probably would have filed a case against her. Mm-hmm. And we represent parents who are also facing child welfare allegations by ACS in court, and we do a lot of cases. And the ability for an allegation that's pretty much unsubstantiated and not very well investigated to land somebody in family court and have their child removed from them is, I mean, I think you're hearing more about that later in the segment, but it is very stark and very disturbing because, you know, what you saw in this video, if you watched it, that's what it's like when they take a child away from a parent, even in family court and when ACS goes to someone's home, they bring a police officer, and it probably doesn't look a lot different than what we saw.
You mean physically ripping a child out of his mother's arms?
Exactly. That's what child removal looks like, right? And it's, you know, it's once you see it, I think we can really understand how upset parents are when they come to court and how little we should be doing that. You know, we should be avoiding that at all costs.
Well, what's even the allegation here? Because what I've seen in the press, anyway, maybe there's more to it that I haven't seen, is that all she did was sit on the floor with the baby, and because there were no seats while she was waiting for her benefit proceedings, and then refused to get up when she was asked to get up. How is that endangering the welfare of a child or potentially being an unfit mother?
Well, that's exactly what happened. That is exactly. I've spoken to Jasmine myself. She was, and other witnesses who saw it. There was no seats. She was sitting in a spot on the floor with an infant. Obviously, it's hard to stand for a long time with a baby. She'd been in the center for 4 hours already. And the reason she was there was because she was eligible for child care benefits. She had gotten a job, and they were paying for child care. And the child care had been cut off. And she found that out when the child care provider called her and said, you know, there's a problem. We're not getting the checks. And she was going down there to try to straighten it out. And so she was there for a very long time, and she needs to sit down. And the security guard, and again, I'm not sure. I think it was security and I'm not sure whether it was security or I know they have in-house police, but I think it's security. I just kept saying, you can't sit, and you need to stand. And she was just instructed to stand up. And she just said, I can't stand up. I'm going to sit. And, I think the witnesses all feel, I mean, there was no, I know we're hearing a lot about de-escalation, but there was no escalation. She just basically said, I'm going to sit here with my baby. And the baby wasn't crying. There was no interaction. She just stayed there. And she wasn't even protesting. She was just needed to sit down. And next thing she knew, the police were there.
I want to thank our reporters for standing by patiently while we've treated our caller, Lisa from Brooklyn Defender Services, who is the lawyer for Jasmine Headley, treating Lisa like an additional guest. And we also have the Brooklyn Borough President, Eric Adams, standing by. But with us in the studio are Nikita Stewart, New York Times Metro reporter covering social services, and Harry DiPrinzio, reporter at City Limits. Nikita, you were nodding your head a minute ago. I'm just curious if, as a journalist, you'd like to ask Lisa a question.
Oh, wow. I have a lot of questions, Lisa. Actually, I guess it would probably happen offline. But here, you're saying that she doesn't – I guess what are you going to do in court today? What will be your argument in trying to get Ms. Headley released?
Were you able to hear the question, Lisa?
I'm sorry, you asking me that question?
Yes, she's asking you. What are you going to do in court to try to get a release?
The law does allow for a judge to release or set bail on a extradition, but that has to be a separate filing has to be made into a different court than she's currently being heard, and we're going to file that this morning. At the same time, the district attorney has worked with the New Jersey that if this doesn't work out, that she will be picked up tomorrow morning.
And has ACS actually filed a case against her? Or
no, and we certainly hope they don't. There's absolutely no reason why they would do that.
Okay.
Lisa, thank you very much for calling and helping to inform our listeners about the details of what's going on right now with this video having gone so viral. A lot of people are wondering, what is the status of Jasmine Headley after being arrested at this assistance center in Brooklyn on Friday for apparently no more than sitting on the floor with her one-year-old baby when there were no seats while she was waiting for her childcare conversation with a social services worker to take place. So thank you very much for chiming in.
Thank you.
And Harry DiPrinzio from City Limits. Let's take a step back a little bit. Despite this shocking recent development, you've reported for City Limits how there are fewer children in foster care this year than previous years, correct?
Correct. So so the number of children in foster care is going down as ACS makes efforts to place children with families and in placements close to home. So the number of children actually in foster care is going down. One thing I highlighted in my recent story, though, is that the rate of abuse in foster care, though, is rising. It rose 140% over the last 4 years, despite that drop of children in foster care.
Is there a pattern to that?
Somewhat. The pattern, perhaps, is that, there are a number of explanations. ACS is there's a large number of those allegations of or instances of abuse occur actually when children are being reunited with their families. That's about 80% of those instances of abuse, and so those might be happening for any number of reasons. The instances of abuse that are getting called in the first place to ACS and child welfare agencies around the country have been rising. And so the rise in those kind of instances mirrors those.
So before we bring on the Brooklyn Borough President, who is going to also talk about the incident with Jasmine Headley, there seem to be, pulls in both directions here. Because according to the Department of Investigation report that you wrote about, Harry, the instances of abuse, as you were just describing, tend to occur outside the foster home, most likely when children were reunited on a trial basis with their original families, which raises a question, are children being reunified with their families too quickly? On the other side, Nikita already raised the pattern that we see of children being taken away from their families too quickly.
Nikita.
Well, I'm just going to also say that, you know, we have to define abuse. And many times when there are those initial calls into ACS by mandated reporters, it could be something as small as it was 35 degrees, the child didn't have a coat, a teacher decided that, you know, she had to call ACS because the child was neglected because the child didn't have a coat, instead of dealing with the underlying issue of, you know, why didn't the child have a coat? Not necessarily because the parent said, no, I'm not putting a coat on you, but I can't afford a coat and, you know, you don't have one today. And New York is one of just like a half dozen states where the threshold for calling something abuse and neglect is very low. And there are plenty of advocates who are trying to make changes to the law. And that is actually at the state level, not at the city level. And also, there is an interesting correlation that folks are missing. I haven't written about it explicitly, but it was in the mayor's management report. And it talked about how reports about that increase in reports, because they're from mandated reporters. And where are those mandated reporters? Schools and shelters. There is a correlation between the high number now of families who have entered shelter, who are now entering systems where they have to go to the office. All of these folks have to, are by law, have to report even the smallest thing they see. And, you know, it can be very disruptive to families.
Is this an overreaction, in your opinion, to past cases which have made big news where a child was severely abused, even killed in some of those cases, and ACS did not intervene in time?
Yes. I mean, I think in all of these instances, you can see overcorrecting and overreaching. But I'm sorry to say that, unfortunately, there will be a child death, and we'll look at that child death and we'll say, what did the mandated reporters do? So this is one of those things where people have to use discretion, but, you know, should there be more training? Should there be a layer before you get to, you know, an actual ACS case or calling the police or, you know, any number of things that – any number of actions
taken. More extreme steps.
Yes.
Also with us now for a few minutes is the Brooklyn Borough President, Eric Adams. President Adams, thank you for joining us. Hello.
Thank you very much. And I really want to just, you know, take a second to just drill down on what Nikita was saying and how important it is that the answer can't be being too quick in removing a child from the home, but properly identifying those abusive cases. I recall as a member of the New York City Police Department, I would go to a home where a neighbor may have called because they saw something with a child. And when you get there, you find out there's some underlying conditions. You know, a child may not have received something to eat because the mother doesn't have any money. She's living alone. And, you know, there were simple things that we were able to do when we brought a level of compassion to people who were in crisis that prevented from that family from being disrupted. And I think that's so important. So a child not having a coat, there were those of us who did simple things like buying that child that coat. It wasn't that the mother was abusive. It was that she was dealing with her own crisis. And when you look at what happened yesterday, over the weekend at the center, you're seeing that there are far too many people who are interacting with individuals and families who are going through crisis and trauma that they're not trained enough to, number one, identify when someone's in crisis, and number two, understand that the answer to resolving a crisis, emotional crisis, is not incarceration and the police. We use that too often, particularly in communities where they are economically challenging or there's some serious emotional issues that people are going through.
You are a former police officer yourself. Listeners should know. What did you think when you saw the video of the way the NYPD officers on the scene responded, including at one point, it's very clear on the video, one of them pulls out a taser?
And this is the problem that you're finding across the entire city. As I say often, police officers leave their precinct with a toolbox full of tools on how to correct conditions. Far too often when they go to the Brownsvilles of New York City and America, they go and pull out not all their tools, they pull out just the hammer. And they believe that it's an effective way of solving all issues. But to not spend time, and number one, as soon as you pulled up at that center, you should have pulled up the understanding, I'm entering an area where families and people are in crisis. Now let's go in there and de-escalate any tension. So there was not a desire to talk, to speak, or do something simple as, how about giving her a chair? How about kneeling down on the floor next to her and sit there and speak with her as a human being, a person who has lost her dignity between her interaction? And that is what it's going to take for the first responders and for those who are inside these centers. Why didn't the social worker go over to her and comfort her and walk her back from the tension and the anger she was feeling? That is what's missing when you're just dealing with people as numbers and not as individuals.
We have a few more minutes to talk about issues raised by the incident caught on video at a social services center in Brooklyn on Friday, where a 23-year-old mother, Jasmine Headley, with a 1-year-old baby, was at an assistance center to pick up daycare vouchers for her child when she was approached by officers, apparently for sitting on the floor when there were no seats and refusing to get up, and some other issues as well that are feeding into this conversation. But, President, one other thing that relates to the NYPD, another impetus for this segment today, is that there's been reporting about kids who run away being arrested, not just, and this probably plays right into your simple solutions narrative, but being actually arrested as a way of returning them to their foster homes. Are you aware of this issue?
No, this is the first time I'm hearing if it's done as a policy, and it shouldn't be done as a policy. There's a reason a child is running away from a foster home. We need to dig into that. When you look at the staffing problems, when you look at our unwillingness to really peel back, and I think that was at the heart of what Nikita was talking about, to peel back what is causing the actions. What are these children are attempting to communicate? I've learned that children don't often verbalize their issues as much as they carry out actions that are saying, I am hurting and I am in pain and I need assistance. And that is what we need to start doing as a city.
Ivy's brother used to sing this when he came in from the tobacco fields. Mama, is Master gonna sell us tomorrow? Yes, yes, yes. Mama, is Master gonna sell us tomorrow? Yes, yes. Yes.
We're going to hear now about what one historic institution is doing to acknowledge its past. Just outside Charlottesville, Virginia, America's fifth president, James Monroe, owned a plantation called Highland. For the first time in its 225-year history, the site has begun talking with descendants of the African Americans that he enslaved. Jordy Yeager has the story.
The cemetery where George Monroe Jr.'s grandparents are buried is hidden away and hard to find.
That grave over there is Umbaba.
That's the Monroe grave, right?
Yeah. You want to see?
Mm-hmm.
He has his kids with him at the cemetery, which is a few miles from where James Monroe once enslaved at least 49 men, women, and children. After emancipation, many kept the Monroe name, bought land, and built Monroe Town. Over the generations, many Monroes moved on, but they come back to visit.
The road that we took to come down here is the road that my father used to bring us when we come down here. And I always say, you know what, Dad? That's pretty cool. That's our last name. I'm like 5, 6 years old.
His dad would nod.
And then it wasn't until I got like to maybe 16 or 17 and I started asking questions. I said, are we linked? And they were like, well, yeah. But then they won't say anything else about it, right?
Highland is now run as a historic site near Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. It hosts weddings, concerts, and draws thousands of tourists each year. But until recently, the enslaved weren't much talked about. And that's a problem, says Executive Director Sarah Bon Harper. So over the last year, she's forged relationships with more than a dozen descendants. She wants them to tell the story of Highland.
Thinking about how things are going to shift or change or evolve is a great question because I have no idea. And that's okay.
One afternoon, the group of descendants toured the property with a guide, walking past a 300-year-old oak tree.
If your ancestors definitely saw the tree.
Some changes will be major. Bon Harper wants tourists to learn about slavery everywhere they go, discuss Monroe, discuss the enslaved. This bridges the past with the present, opening the door for talks about Jim Crow laws, racism, and white supremacist violence. Changes are also in the details, in the language.
Like when I started, people said this was Monroe's study.
On their tour, the group of descendants goes inside the big house.
But in terms of like the progression of the house, when Monroe built it in 1818... Like
when Monroe built it. Actually, Waltine Eubank says it was her enslaved ancestors, like carpenters Peter and George, who built the houses.
When visitors come, they won't think that James Monroe did all of this by himself.
Highland's not alone in realizing they've only told half the story. Earlier this year, at James Madison's former plantation, Montpelier, Bon Harper and George Monroe Jr. joined site directors, archaeologists, historians, and descendants to create a guide to tell more accurate and complete narratives. That's important for George's cousin, Waltine, who says the painful history of slavery and its continuing legacies are like a boil on the skin.
What we are doing here now, we have opened the boil related to the slaves and our descendants here on this plantation that is also relevant to all plantations. And we are willing to do the work, the dirty, nasty, stinky, pussy work to get our situation healed.
George agrees. American history is messy and filled with hard truths, he says. So lay it all out and talk about it.
And then let's move on from there, you know, and you have a personal choice to make. You have a commitment to make at that point. Once you know the full story, now what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it?
What people do with it, he says, isn't up to him. But what is making sure the truth is finally told. For NPR News, I'm Jordy Yeager in Charlottesville, Virginia.
And it reminded me so much of, you know, what you said. And I was curious as to when you began thinking about racism as a religion. The strongest religion in the universe. When did you start thinking about racism as a religion?
When I made the 9 areas of activity. When I listed those, and the 7th area was religion. And then, naturally, I had to get into defining what religion is. Strong belief backed up by action. And just by that process, stumbled into it. Because then I had to ask myself, okay, well, what is the strongest religion? What's the most prominent religion on the planet, if you go by that definition? Strong belief backed up by action that may or may not have a God at its head, in which case the religion of the white supremacists is white supremacy and the God of that religion of the white supremacists themselves, according to the evidence. So that's how I came into it. It just evolved. Just by me seeking to follow the logic.
The seminary that trains many Southern Baptist preachers is acknowledging something about its history that was widely known but often ignored. It was founded by men who owned slaves and defended slavery. Later leaders preached white supremacy. The Southern Baptist Theological Seminary reviews its legacy of racism in a new report, and we have more now from NPR's Tom Jelton.
The 71-page document is thoroughly researched and unsparing. In an introductory letter, Seminary President Albert Moeller summarizes, "The founding fathers of this school, all 4 of them, were deeply involved in slavery and deeply complicit in the defense of slavery," Moeller writes. "Many of their successors," he says, "advocated segregation and the inferiority of African Americans."
We knew in generalities that the founders of the seminary owned slaves. We knew in generality that they've been very much a part of Southern culture, the culture of Reconstruction and even legal segregation, but it had never been documented.
The report, written by six current and former faculty members, draws heavily on the seminary's own archives. It acknowledges the only reason a separate Southern Baptist denomination was formed back in 1845 was because Northern Baptists refused to appoint slaveholders as missionaries. The Southern Baptist Convention, more than 20 years ago, apologized for its connection to slavery. Last year, it passed a resolution condemning white supremacy. The Southern Baptists today are distinguished from others mainly by their more evangelical and politically conservative identity. Allison Green, a historian of religion at Emory University, says this new report is significant, but she wonders what might follow.
Making a statement about Confederate monuments might be a next step, or taking a stand on questions of voting rights in the 21st century.
There will be more changes, says Albert Moeller, though he can't say what yet. There are no statues on the campus of seminary founders to remove, he says. There are buildings named after the founders. No changes there are planned.
Taking the names off, in one sense, is just an effort to try to hide.
This is the seminary story, Moeller says. The new report is the school taking responsibility for its history. Tom Gelton, NPR News.
Mama says policemen shoot black people.
Is it true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true? Is it true?
It's a very complex case with not only two different shootings in the same event, but in a crowded shopping mall with potentially hundreds of witnesses and possibly multiple videos involved. So they're working through a tremendous volume of evidence and working hard to try to find the truth of what took place that night.
I want to move back to the night of the shooting, and you, Mayor Brocato, the chief of police, and other officials within just a few hours came out and announced at a late-night press conference that police had shot and killed the shooter. The mall reopened early the next morning, and then later we found out that Emantic Bradford Jr. wasn't the gunman that night. So what went wrong? I mean, how does something like this happen? Why were you so quick to name the shooter? Mayor Brocato.
Well, you have to look at the circumstances. You had a very crowded mall that night. People out enjoying themselves, shopping, packed. And you had gunfire that erupted in the middle of the mall. And you had police officers that were there, within seconds. And so the situation was apparent to them at that time that maybe they had engaged the shooter. So, I learned the next day that was not the facts. And so certainly what we did is immediately corrected that. And that's what we've wanted to do all along. We wanted to make sure that we've been very transparent, open, admit any mistakes that we have. And remember that quickly after this occurred, the investigating agencies that would be investigating us as well came in quickly and collected all of the evidence. And so we worked very close with them to make sure that they had everything that we had.
So, Mayor Brocato, you said you that night yourself were under the impression that Bradford was the shooter.
I was. When I arrived on the scene, that was the information that I was given.
By whom?
By the police department.
It's important for us to say that the city of Hoover and the police department never released Mr. Bradford's name or image. We actually didn't know his name because he didn't possess any identification that night. Tragically, the incident was revealed to his family via social media, and that's something that was beyond our control. But we never identified him by name until we put out the statement stating that he was not actually the shooter. We know that Mr. Bradford and Brian Wilson, who was a shooting victim, are close friends. So there's a lot of the story that remains to be told.
You don't have to look very far to see chatter right now on social media and elsewhere about the city of Hoover, particularly among minorities, that the city is racist or that the city police are racist. And also, chatter among other folks regarding the protesters, who are mostly black, calling them racist. And now there's just this strong racial undertone to this whole tragedy. What is the city doing to quell some of that? Mayor Brocato.
Well, you know, we're aware of that. And we're saddened to hear that, because we really don't believe that Hoover is a racist city. If you look at our demographics, we are a very diverse city, probably as diverse as any city in the United States. And we take a lot of pride in the fact that we are a city that's diverse. Our police department is diverse, and it's the most diverse department in our city. We hear that. I mean, we can't ignore the chatter. That's incumbent upon us as we move forward after the investigation, get all of this laid out. Let's get to the truth. It's important for us to start that healing process, particularly in the leadership in our African American community.
How do you plan to do that?
Well, we've already, some have reached out to us, and we have reached out to them as well. This is a sad thing for the city of Hoover, and we want to get it right. We don't believe we're that kind of city. We want to be a model for how this was handled, and we don't want it to happen again.
You know, the attorney for the family of Emantic Bradford Jr. is calling for the release of video footage. Demonstrators are calling for the release of this footage, and people out in the community are looking for more information on the shooting. How much longer can people expect to wait before we know a little bit more about what happened that night?
Right. So, but Mr. Crump, the family's attorney, has actually seen some video footage that's been made available to him. He did not disclose that, but we're all aware now that he's seen video footage.
Mr. Crump has come out and said that, as you said, he has seen some of the video, and the family has, but they're saying that that's not enough. They want to see more.
Sure, absolutely. We all want to see it. We all want to see all the evidence. And Aaliyah has notified all of us, including the family, that they have an internal policy or goal of a 60-day investigation on officer-involved shootings. Now, that's a guideline. I don't think that they can make any guarantee that things will happen within that time frame. They've also told all of us that this is a very complex investigation. Multiple shootings, multiple weapons, and hundreds of potential witnesses. So we can't say a date certain. I don't believe Aaliyah can say a date certain. And we're just all waiting, and we're waiting for the full truth. And that really has to be our focus. We'd like it now, but we'd rather have it correct.
The first thing we're going to do to, I think, stop racism is stop focusing on racism.
Stop focusing on racism.
A bill that could bring big change to the criminal justice system got the go-ahead today from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. After weeks of apparent reluctance, McConnell said he will allow the Senate to vote on the measure. NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe joins us now. Hey there, Aisha. Welcome to the studio.
Hello.
So before we get into the politics of the bill, remind us just what's in it, what it would do.
So essentially, it provides incentives to certain prisoners to take part in training programs that would help them after being released from prison. And in exchange, they get their time in prison reduced. It also lowers mandatory minimum sentences for certain drug offenses, and it would give judges discretion in certain cases not to impose mandatory minimum sentencing requirements. This is a bill that has a lot of support from the White House and from various groups, including the ACLU and from conservative activists like the Koch brothers.
Even with all that support, the Senate Majority Leader has been hesitant to schedule a vote. So what's changed?
Well, he's been facing a lot of pressure from conservatives, from the White House. Groups had been urging supporters to flood his offices with messages pushing him to take action. You had President Trump tweeting about this last week, and then you had his advisor, Jared Kushner, on Fox News last night promoting this bill. So there was a lot of pressure for McConnell to do something. To help move things along, sponsors of the bill agreed to make some changes. That was enough to get McConnell to agree to allow a vote, but it still seems like he's not totally sold on the bill.
I'm still looking at it. It's going to have some amendments. I think Senator Cotton and those who have his view are entitled to amendments. I'm going to make sure they can offer them, and then decide based on what the bill looks like at the end whether to support it.
So that's McConnell mentioning allowing amendments from Senator Tom Cotton, who has been a big opponent of the bill. Advocates have raised concerns in the past that if the bill is changed too much, that they might lose support from Democrats. But some activists are saying they're confident that they'll be able to overcome any amendments that Cotton might offer up.
I mean, you mentioned that negotiators have already made changes, right, in order to get McConnell to allow a vote. So what? Tell us more about these changes.
So critics of the bill, like Cotton, were saying that it would let out these violent criminals and that that would lead to more crime. So to address those concerns, lawmakers have limited the type of offenders who would be eligible for this program for supervised release. And they also narrowed a measure that granted judges more discretion to waive mandatory minimum sentences.
And the supporters of the measure, are they okay with these changes?
Well, I talked to one supporter, Enimai Chettier of the Brennan Center for Justice, a nonpartisan group that advocates for ending mass incarceration. Her group doesn't agree with the changes, but it still supports the bill because they say the overall impact will largely be the same. The general consensus among supporters of the bill seems to be that they're cautiously optimistic. They're hopeful that this will make it into law, but right now they're not really spiking the football because they say that things could fall apart.
That's NPR's Aisha Roscoe. Aisha, thank you.
Thank you.
I don't want to cause any problems, Lieutenant. I just want a new partner.
Oh, I understand. Your partner's a racist prick. But you don't want to stir up any bad feelings with him.
Well, he's been on the force for a long time. And
17 years.
And I do have to work here, sir.
So, you don't mind that there's a racist prick on the force. You just don't want him to ride in your car.
If you need me to go on record about this, sir, I will.
That'd be great. Write a full report. Because I'm anxious to understand how an obvious bigot could have gone undetected in this department for 17 years. 11 of which he was under my personal supervision. Which doesn't speak very highly of my managerial skills. But that's not your concern. I can't wait to read it.
And first at 5 o'clock, the Prince George's County Police Department hit with a discrimination lawsuit.
More than a dozen of its own Hispanic or African-American officers saying they face discrimination and retaliation. Maryland Bureau Chief Brad Bell with more on what these officers claim. Brad.
Yeah, the officers are saying it is a widespread problem and it has been going on for years, discrimination against officers of color and favoritism for white officers. They say they have complained about it. They have filed reports for years, but they've never gotten any remedies, so they have no choice now, they say, but to go to court.
These officers have filed complaints before, including to the Department of Justice, but this is the first time they've spoken out publicly.
This administration has targeted each and every one of us.
PGPD Captain Joe Perez, president of the Hispanic National Law Enforcement Officers Association, says officers of color have been systematically treated unfairly by the department, and the federal lawsuit he and the others filed today seeks change, both in practice and leadership of the department. He says he himself has been denied promotion to major because of his activism.
I was marginalized. All right. And I was moved out.
Former Corporal Michael Brown, who was fired after an altercation in D.C. during which he pulled his gun and had his termination upheld in court, says he was treated more harshly because of his race.
This attack on me by a corrupt administration was unfair. One of the biggest issues regarding the Prince George's County Police Department is discipline when it comes to white officers and minorities.
County Executive Angela Alsobrooks, pointing out she is only a week and a half into the job, says she hasn't read the lawsuit, but will investigate the concerns.
I think I'd need an opportunity to have more of a chance to hear first what the allegations are, not just from these officers, but to have an opportunity as well to look at the agency.
So the officers, in addition to filing their lawsuit today publicly, are demanding a change at the top in the agency. They say there needs to be a new chief, and Chief Hank Stawinski must go. County Executive Alsobrooks says that she is concerned about these allegations, but today she is expressing support for Chief Stawinski, and she says that they have had a good working relationship over the past several years. Chief Stawinski not able to comment, according to a spokesperson, because of the pending litigation. At Prince George's County Police Headquarters, Brad Bell, ABC 7.
get on a plane to go anywhere, and chances are you are sitting in a seat made right here in North Texas. The company is called Zodiac Seats. It's based in Gainesville, north of Denton. And tonight it is facing a lawsuit for racial discrimination. Jason Whiteley shows us the evidence.
1461 Arnav, the Navy, runway 17.
It's doubtful you have flown anywhere without sitting in a seat made by this company in Gainesville, an hour north of Fort Worth.
2310, reach approach 17 left.
Joseph Asagba made armrests at Zodiac Seats.
That's me in 1977.
He moved here from Nigeria, never expecting what he would experience.
When I came to the United States, I never experienced discrimination in my life.
Asagba recently filed a federal lawsuit accusing the popular airplane seat maker of discriminating against him, starting with his supervisor.
I was talking to some of my coworkers, and then he stood up and said, Joseph, you black monkey, go back to work.
Asagba says he reported his supervisor to Human Resources.
They suspended him for some days. So when he came back, he started telling people that I was trying to get him fired. And I'm like, how am I going to try to get you fired? You're the one that called me black monkey.
2 months later, this happened.
That is the news that they placed on my desk.
A noose put on his desk, he says, by two white women, also reported to HR. The next day, a white coworker said the word hanging as Asagba walked by, his lawsuit adds. And not long after, he says Zodiac Seats retaliated against him and demoted him to the assembly line.
Any use of a racial slur, or especially a noose in the workplace, is beyond the pale. But then after that occurs, it's incumbent upon any employer to do the right thing, to discipline employees, to train remaining employees, and to not retaliate against an employee that comes forward with a complaint.
So what does Zodiac Seats have to say? An attorney for the company would not comment on Mr. Asagba's specific allegations, but the attorney says the company denies them and plans to defend itself to the fullest in federal court.
I just want justice done, that's all.
For now, this father of five remains employed there in a lower position, now actually assembling the airplane seats we sit in, awaiting a judge to consider the evidence he has. Jason Whiteley, Channel 8 News.
This is CNN, a network of Turner Broadcasting System.
We begin with the fractious issue of Palestine and Israel in the U.S. news media, the boundaries around that discussion, who gets to set them, and what, ultimately, is allowed to be said. Last week, a CNN contributor, a commentator the network had on its payroll, delivered a speech at the United Nations in support of Palestinian self-determination and equal rights. Less than 24 hours later, CNN was done with Mark Lamont Hill. When you boil it down, he was fired for using the following six words, from the river to the sea. That was deemed anti-Semitic. Hill's dismissal came on the heels of a seemingly coordinated attack by pro-Israel groups that have come to have a large say over what constitutes acceptable discourse on Palestine in the U.S. by willfully conflating legitimate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism and then convincing news outlets to do the same. It wasn't that long ago that CNN adopted the slogan, "Facts First." When it comes to Israel, though, it's much more complicated than that. Some facts are clearly more inconvenient than others. Our starting point this week is the UN's headquarters in New York City.
It is with great honor and humility that I accept the opportunity to speak before you.
The speech lasted 21 minutes and 7 seconds.
The Israeli nation state continues to restrict freedom and undermine equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, as well as those in the West Bank and Gaza.
It consisted of 2,837 words.
I promise you that I will not exhaust all of my time by enumerating every human rights violation perpetrated by the Israeli government.
Had the speech been six words shorter, Mark Lamont Hill would still be employed by CNN. Had he ended it like this.
Give us what justice requires, and that is a free Palestine.
Instead, he chose to end it like this.
A free Palestine, from the river to the sea.
When Mark Lamont Hill says a free Palestine from the river to the sea, he is acknowledging that Palestinians aren't just clustered in the West Bank and Gaza, but in fact we are from places like Akka and Jaffa and Majdad and the Galilee and all parts of Palestine. And the significance of this is that Israel has always sought to erase this historic fact. They're not just objecting to use of the words from the river to the sea, but Palestine.
Now, I understand why the vagueness of that term may lead some to misinterpret it. I understand that somebody who identifies as a pro-Israel Zionist may have an issue with a one-state vision because equal rights for everyone would effectively mean the end of the Jewish state, a state that privileges the Jewish population over the non-Jewish population. That's why we see people resorting to a smear campaign.
So CNN not only had every right to fire him, this was a piece of open anti-Semitism.
Effectively misdirecting what those words actually mean.
That's right out of a Hamas script that calls for the annihilation of Israel.
That is not what that phrase means at all.
People decided to zoom in on what was supposedly the true subtext of what he is saying. It's an active search to find a delegitimizing sentence that reveals some nefarious intent in a call for freedom. And we see that over and over again. And one of the main drivers to that force is the conflation between critique of Israel and anti-Semitism.
In the 20-minute speech, he said many righteous and important things about the plight of Palestinians. At the same time, you know, if somebody gave a beautiful speech and then in the middle of it said the N-word, we would be right to sort of focus on that. Now, again, I don't think that the phrase from the river to the sea is necessarily anti-Semitic, but it was interpreted that way by many Jews, and so I think it was fair to focus on that.
But how was that interpretation arrived at? The Anti-Defamation League, a Jewish NGO based in the U.S., said Lamont Hill's use of the phrase from the river to the sea meant that he was calling for the end of the State of Israel. The ADL describes itself as a civil rights organization that fights bigotry and anti-Semitism in the U.S. However, it has little or no tolerance for those who question Israeli government policies. Collectively, pro-Israel lobby groups in Washington, including the ADL, AIPAC, the Jewish Federation of America, and others, are the kings of conflation. They carry a lot of weight with politicians and the media alike. And when CNN saw the online pushback to what Lamont Hill had said, it just rolled over and cut him loose.
This is definitely an organized campaign that is attempting to misrepresent Hill's views. Somebody like Ben Shapiro, who is a host at Fox News right now, is openly an advocate of Israel ethnically cleansing Palestinians from the Palestinian territories. Seth Mandel, who is the editor of the Washington Examiner, made the most egregious charge against Hill, accusing him of advocating for genocide. And CNN, by caving to the smear campaign, is absolutely playing into the hands of people who want to make the conflation and are undermining free speech in the process.
There's definitely a problem right now in the public sphere where some versions of anti-Zionism or opposition to Israel are immediately called by some on the right anti-Semitic. This is, of course, a huge problem. In terms of what Mark Lamont Hill said, I think CNN was thinking probably about its viewers and about the Jewish community and saying, well, the majority of the community viewed this as deeply problematic, as something that threatens their very existence, and so they made the decision based on that.
CNN essentially perpetuated this narrative, this false dichotomy, this idea that you have to choose. Don't critique Israel or be anti-Semitic. It's even more problematic because of the positive role that it could play in this conflict and this narrative. That discussion will not be on CNN because they fired Dr. Hill. But that will be a perfect place and a perfect opportunity to have this discussion.
Michael Oren is with us.
With us now from Massachusetts, Professor Alan Dershowitz.
Rick Santorum, thanks so much for being here, Senator.
Thank you, James.
CNN's treatment of the Middle East conflict can be measured not just in the pro-Israel voices it pays to provide punditry, like the former Israeli ambassador to Washington, Michael Oren, ex-U.S. Senator Rick Santorum, and lawyer Alan Dershowitz, but in the airtime they are given.
Israel wants peace.
Even the Anti-Defamation League has said Oren's opinions verge on conspiracy theories, yet he's still a paid CNN contributor and is often interviewed by Wolf Blitzer. Blitzer's bio on CNN's news site is as revealing about the network as it is about him. It's an extensive and detailed summary of a career going back 40 years. But nowhere does CNN mention...
Now I'd like to address Mr. Blitzer.
...that in the 1980s, Blitzer worked at AIPAC. He was a paid lobbyist for Israel.
Before all of us should be delighted that we happen to be around at a time in this world when there is this Israel.
We wrote to CNN with a series of questions on this story, but did not hear back. And Wolf Blitzer is not just another face on the network. He is CNN's lead political anchor.
It's institutional. It's embedded in the fabric of CNN. They bolster it with guests like Michael Oren.
Israel will take whatever measures are necessary to defend its citizens.
And Rick Santorum, for example, denying that Palestinians even exist.
All the people that live in the West Bank are Israelis. They're not Palestinians. There is no Palestinian.
All these people get to stay on CNN. And Wolf Blitzer, who is, you know, an ardent Zionist and with a history of working for the Israeli lobby, he gets to frame the story. And rarely do Palestinians ever get a voice on CNN.
It is really interesting to compare the discourse about Israel and Palestine among Israelis and among Americans. When I moved to the United States, I was surprised that the word occupation was uncomfortable to some pro-Israel advocates.
I don't buy the whole idea that the United Nations is calling it occupation. I mean, this is Israel.
In Israel, you do have people talking about the occupation. Until there is a movement in the establishment of the United States politics that can utter these words, that can say, what is the problem that we need to solve? And that is, will be very far from a solution.
The pro-Israel lobby's work to influence American political discourse extends into academia. The Canary Mission is a website that compiles dossiers on pro-Palestinian college students and professors in the U.S. Some of those named on it say it's akin to a blacklist designed to intimidate them into silence. Al Jazeera has investigated the site, but that documentary has yet to be broadcast, leading some to speculate that even Al Jazeera is not immune to pressure from the pro-Israel lobby in the U.S., which the network denies. Professor Mark Lamont Hill, an academic now deposed from the media platform CNN gave him, would know both sides of that story. But, as of this writing, he's not talking, which is the whole point of the exercise.
It is crucial for people to understand the magnitude of the threat to free speech in the form of denying the ability of pro-Palestine activists to be part of the narrative in the United States. This takes many forms. We are facing a very serious threat to free speech in the form of denying the right to speak honestly about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the right to advocate on it.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, December 15, 2018, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. We had lots of disruptions during the broadcast. The internet connection went out several times. When we were broadcasting yesterday, there was a very nasty storm. As we have been broadcasting, the wind has picked up, so I don't know if that is influencing things, but the internet connection has been very uncooperative for the duration, and it's tried rebooting and restarting, but that's just been an extreme disruption for the broadcast. I can't it's been a while since I can recall just the whole internet signal going out repeatedly when we were broadcasting. Add that to the list of tech issues. Again, there's been lots of interference over the last 12 months in particular with the disruption to the iTunes feed and lots of listeners reporting having difficulties being able to call in during the live program. So, usual suspects, racist man, racist woman, and again, as I've said for almost the full 10 years that we've been here, if you are doing anything that is working against racism, white supremacy, you should expect interference. Racists, they keep an eye on the plantation and anything that might be disruptive, bad for the business of white supremacy. That's it. This is Compensatory Call-In, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Few things to share before we get started. I got disrupted because there were so many spots where there were disconnects because of the internet signal, the Wi-Fi going out, likely racist interference. So I want to make sure that I share this. I took notes, but even my note-taking got jangled because of the disruptions. The segment that was talking about in Seattle, where they started school like an hour later, and it had such a constructive impact. I played that. I remember, as a Seattle resident, I remember some years back when they were talking about that, and then when they changed the law, said, okay, yeah, we're going to start school an hour later. Whew. No metaphor. It literally brought tears to my eyes. Now, I did not grow up in the Seattle area. I probably would be no cows if I had. That's another dialogue. So I didn't go to school in this area, but I struggled. Sleep is such a huge factor. I know so many victims of racism, listeners of this program and just period in general, who have sleep difficulties. There are reports that talk about how because of racism, Black people have more higher rates of insomnia and just more difficulty getting quality rest. I remember as a student, getting up and just wishing school started an hour later. Just if we could start a little bit later in the day, oh, I would feel so much better. I'm not a morning person. I would get more rest. I think I've seen studies where they say teens in particular need more rest. I know they say that about children, but I think they said teens need more rest because they're doing all that growing, got all those hormones and everything. But in Seattle, lots of white students. They have more whites out here than most other places that you're going to be talking about. In fact, I can recall a specific incident of how sleep deprived I was. I took AP calculus as a senior. I remember taking the calculus, taking a calculus exam. You take many during the year. We're taking a calculus exam. I remember being so tired that I was dozing off taking the exam. I literally, suspected racist white male student was next to me, literally was nudging me, wake up, wake up, we got to take our test, wake up, wake up, so that I could, you know, wake up and take the test. Now, victim of racism, white supremacy, barely have two pieces of cornbread to, that's a metaphor. Victim of white supremacy with no resources, no power, impotent on the plantation. All of that being true, Gus T was a pretty stellar math student. We took the math test. We got our test back. I actually got a better grade on the test than he did. He was furious and said, I should have not waken you up and just let you sleep. And then I would have done great on the test and you would have done poorly. Anywho, sleep is so important, and not getting quality rest as a young person, that ends up a lot of those habits, they call them, get formed at a young age and end up being really bad patterns for the duration of our time on the planet. That happens with food. That can happen with sleep. Racists, so much of this is by design, in my opinion. Certainly with food can stick right on things. So I do not forget with Seattle hit two times, they talked about they have food ratings. If you haven't been to Seattle, I don't know how it is in other places, but in Seattle, the public restaurants, they have big smiley faces out front so that you know what their cleanliness their hygiene reading is. You can see it. They brag about this right out front. Very easy to read if you go to an establishment. As they said in the report, they don't have this for the schools. If you go and you get a school lunch, public schools. And they said that this is going to disproportionately impact. Now, they didn't say black children. They said low income and all the other niggerish terms that they will include as opposed to victims of white supremacy, non-white people. They're going to be the ones that really are impacted when they're shoveling out all of this unsafe food. And they're not even talking about, you know, that they have organic kale and organic carrots. They're just talking about if we are going to serve them bologna sandwiches and Spam, you know, at least did we wash our hands before we put the bologna sandwich? That's all they're talking about, just bare minimums, and how that's not even being followed. No surprise. And again, I think last week it was about them having armed, and you can even compare. Sometimes it's wonderful. I got my metaphor segment coming up, but to compare and contrast, that is a wonderful skill. Now, last week we had the segment where they were talking about having armed resource officers in the school. Didn't they have the segment where they if a student had a knife and he said, I'm going to shoot him, bam, shoot to kill. And the guy in the training, he said, I hesitated. I don't know. Should I shoot to kill if a child has a knife? And the trainer said, that's why you're in training, so you don't hesitate. Put him down, bam. That's what you got last week. This week, can we at least wash our hands and have the bologna sandwich in the refrigerator before we give it to the Negro children? Can we at least do that? Can we get them a clean fork if we're going to serve Cheetos? At least a clean fork. Come on. So, and again, what does that fool say all the time? Don't care about children. You can't even get the lunch delivered correctly. It's 2018. I said that, I brought that up before. All the technology, they got, this is Seattle. They got the Amazon store with no people in it. All of the gadgetry that they got in Seattle, and you can't even get the lunches straight for the children. Fool says all the time, whites don't care about children. I say that all the time. There's so many examples, aplenty. Going down my list, again, apologies if there's any disruption to the audio. The internet has just been amazingly uncooperative today. Say every compensatory call in the cows is listener supported counter racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. 10 years we have been on the air. We would not be here if it were not for listeners. We do not have huge white investors that have kept us on the air, made sure our internet is behaving properly. That has not been the case. We have just had listeners who have made sure we are able to broadcast for the last decade. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can hit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. If you are not into PayPal, you can, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, you can drop me an email and I will get you a physical mailing address. Again, tremendous gratitude to all the folks who have supported. Just below the PayPal button, which is in the top right corner of the blog, is my Amazon wish list link. You can click that. It's listed at Amazon under Gus T. Renegade. Again, huge thanks to all the folks, investors, who have supported for the past 10 years nabbing items from the wish list. I hope the cows has provided accurate, constructive information on what it means to be classified as white, what the system of white supremacy racism is, and things non-white people victims of white supremacy can do to help end this system immediately, produce justice. A few more items before we get to the callers. Still getting the details together for the yoga retreat for the 10-year anniversary. We'll email details out for that shortly. Much obliged to all the folks who have emailed their interest. Much obliged. We'll respond to everyone who has emailed about that. UntilJustice@gmail.com for February, excuse me, February 2019. Ooh, something in my throat. All right. A few other items to share. Share the broadcast since we are under such attack. Perhaps we are doing a few things that are constructive towards replacing white supremacy with justice. Share the broadcast, social media, other platforms. Let people know that we are on and broadcasting. They can tune in to share their views for the evening. The case, I think, that got a lot of attention with Miss Headley, Jasmine Headley, the black mom in New York, god-awful New York. I think that is an illustration, again, why Mr. Fuller says attempted parents. You have attempted moms, attempted fathers in the system of white supremacy. That sort of thing happens all the time, all over the world. And just being honest about that, being honest with ourselves about that, even when we talk about having some of us having 200 questions before sexual intercourse, that being on the list, talking about that, you know, are we all right producing offspring, knowing that this is the world that we live, that could be me, that could be us anytime, snatched whoop, off to wherever, and, you know, we're caged wherever happens to be, that could be us. We're okay having a child, already knowing that is the world we live in, system of white supremacy, at least being honest with ourselves and each other that is true. I think also in that situation, it wasn't that she was even doing anything, you know, incorrect. I think unless I've been misinformed, they said she was just sitting down. I think they said it was crowded. There were no other seats. It wasn't, she wasn't being rowdy. She wasn't cursing. And that quickly, and that's another one. I talk about that on a regular basis. These things escalate so quickly in the system of racism, white supremacy. I certainly am not saying Ms. Headley did anything incorrect at all. Holding children, they are heavy. We had to do that in prenatal training. They are heavy. I would have tried to sit down on the floor too. I'm not saying she did anything incorrect. I'm just saying in a system of racism, white supremacy, we are accused all the time, mostly when we haven't even done anything incorrect, which seems to be Ms. Headley's case, where she wasn't doing anything wrong. Doesn't matter. System of white supremacy, we're about mistreating Negroes. Doesn't matter even if you got a child with you. We're about mistreating them too. But just understanding things can escalate so fast, and just really trying to be mindful of that as black people, especially, that within five, whatever the request is, to really think about that, this could be the sort of thing where I end up dying. And because I think he could have been killed in that interaction. Didn't they pull out people that saw? And again, I don't watch all those videos, so I've not seen it. I've heard the interaction and read about it, but I didn't watch the video. But unless I've been misinformed, they pulled out a taser and the whole nine. I'm sure they, you know, had their firearms. It could have been a lethal encounter for the child and the mom and or any of the bystanders that were there. I'm sure they got hostile with them about the recording and what have you. That generally happens. So just that is the world that we live in. Just being mindful. Any of these altercations, little skirmishes, or I won't even say little. That's why I don't like the term microaggression. That's not a microaggression. That's terrorism. Any of these incidents when we're out in public, be mindful of that. Have a code. Utilize it. And again, that's why I really recommend making sure that we maintain our composure. Not saying Ms. Headley didn't, just really making sure that we maintain our composure in these situations, because when we don't, wow, things can go a lot worse. If there are parents who have any thoughts on that situation, feel free to share. I do not have children. That's, again, I think that's the same thing I said last week when they were talking about having the resource, armed resource officers, you can put a slash, race soldiers, in the schools, in the classrooms, when they were talking about having them there to shoot to kill. Same thing I said last week. That another illustration of why I do not have offspring. Flagrant illustration The situation about Mark Lamont Hill, I think a listener brought that up within the last week or so, him being terminated at CNN for his remarks. He said what he said regarding Israel, Palestine. I know Mr. Fuller has talked about that, having so many black people, victims of racism, being accused of being what they call anti-Semitic for some of the comments that they make, and why he insists on system of racism, white supremacy, regardless of what geographic location that we're talking about, that there is the problem, and focusing it there, and having heard him talk about that specifically, when other, because that happens on a regular basis, some black person gets in trouble and has to do a lot of apologizing, or sometimes they don't even let them apologize. Sometimes they, you know, permanently silence them for a long period of time. They just get fired and hushed, and you don't get to talk anymore for a while. They do that to black people, on Professor Griff, among many others. They do that on a regular basis. The importance of words. That's why for this program, really being mindful about what we say. It's why I talk about not using metaphor within that very segment. Didn't even need my notes. I could just think about what I heard in that segment. It was a suspected racist white woman, and she said that, it, given the metaphor, she said, okay, Mark Lamont Hill, from the river to the sea, he gave his speech, said what he said. If someone were to give a speech, a beautiful, eloquent speech about justice, and then they said nigger, now we would have to reexamine that right there. I say it all the time. Or at least I say it every compensatory call in, no metaphors. What do I say? Racists, they are master deceivers. They will use metaphors to practice deception. They will take two separate entities and say that this is like this. Someone giving a speech and saying nigger is like Mark Lamont Hill saying from the rivers to the sea. Are you serious? That's the same thing? That's comparable? Really? How so? These are the rapid questions. That's really, be mindful. No one does it better, not even close, using metaphors, using these analogies when they just come out and make a compare. And sometimes it's so simple, you won't even think about it. When they make these comparisons, most of the time it's transferring racist logic so that we are not thinking logically about what's being said. They are superb. No one does it better. Really be mindful when they start dropping, especially if the conversation is about racism and there start to be a lot of analogies and metaphors being used, slow down. Let's stop the conversation. Can we be direct? Did Mark Lamont Hill call somebody a nigger? I missed that part. Is that in the transcript? Did he say nigger? Oh, okay. Let's get back to what he said and what problem exactly there was with what he said. For this program, if we could not use metaphors for the reasons just stated, and victims of white supremacy, such as Gus T., we are still learning. Sometimes, as opposed to having logic to articulate our views, we will substitute and use an analogy, a metaphor, in place of logic. That frequently causes a lot of confusion, problems. If we could do our best to speak directly, explicitly to what it is that we would like to say, that would be appreciated. And sometimes, if we aren't able to do that, you just have to take a little bit more time, do some more thinking, until you get the correct terms. That is allowed, always admired. Also, we had a listener called for the neutralizing workplace racism segment this past Friday. Almost, I was doing better this past Friday. Called in, black male educator. He was in the Connecticut area, Omar Thornton. In the Connecticut area, and he was doing the teacher exam, I think the Praxis, and he was talking about widespread white supremacy with the exam. Black people have a really difficult time passing this exam so that they can be full-time accredited teachers. He's substitute teaching now. And I know we have educators, even though you are not necessarily in Connecticut. If we have any educators who might have tips on how this black male can pass this exam, because he was saying that I think you only have a limited number of times that you can attempt to pass the exam. And if you don't do it a certain amount of time, then they can kick you out of the program or they can terminate your enrollment in the program. And that's a huge waste of time, energy, resources. None of us have unlimited currency. So if we have any listeners who have any suggestions or offerings that might aid this black male educator in passing the Praxis in Connecticut, that would be super appreciated. If you want to dial in and share, that's great. Or if you want to email, I would be happy to forward along untiljustice@gmail.com. But any tips on passing the Praxis teaching exam up in Connecticut? With that, if folks could take about 5 minutes for whatever commentary they would like to share, that way everyone will get at least one chance to speak. If you have additional comments or questions, if you could share towards the end, that would be appreciated. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could please use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just helps minimize the distortions so that people don't have to talk over a lot of unnecessary racket. Much obliged. With that, we will go ahead and get to folks who dialed in. If we have any listeners who are familiar, or I guess I'll get in last two things and then I'll get the callers. If we have any listeners who have read, you don't have to have read the entire book, but if you have read any portions of Michelle Obama's book, if you think it is constructive, worthy of the book club, let us know. We did have people who inquired about that being a possible book for the book study. I myself had said that I had hoped both she and her husband would write a text that gave some insight about the white supremacy they experienced during their time in the White House. If that is offered, I would like to know about it. So if anybody has read or at least skimmed and seen any tidbits from Michelle Obama's new book, I would like to hear. The other quick comment, multiple people wrote like within the past few hours about Robin DiAngelo, suspected racist, and having her on the program. I have mentioned this for years, so this is I will just do this on the air ever so often, because I get tired of responding to this. I despise Robin DiAngelo, suspected race soldier. The entire concept of white fragility, in my view, is deliberately designed to spread confusion. Whites, power. That's the connection, not fragility. That does not make sense at all in any way, shape, or form, especially the way that she articulates it. It doesn't make sense at all, because you have someone who practices racism, white supremacy, and does not want to be indicted as a racist. That doesn't make them fragile. That just makes them like any other criminal, child rapist, who does not want to be indicted as a child rapist. Of course, I'm going to have some apprehension about how we have this discussion, especially if it's on my misdeeds. At any rate, she was invited to be a guest on the program, and this is like years ago. She was invited to be a guest on the program, and she practiced racism and waste my time in the way that she went about her whole exchange. That's why I especially despise Robin DiAngelo. So, no, she declined being a guest on the program in a really deceitful, tacky, and racist manner, in my opinion. She will not be hanging out on the cows, and multiple people asked about her this week. There's your reply. Folks who dialed in, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. There was one other, I guess I will get in the email, because this was all about the disruption that I mentioned before. B in Toronto, she's called in many times. She most recently has been writing and saying that she's been having a lot of interference and dialing in. So she wrote in for the compensatory call-in. She writes, There were some observations that I've noticed that I wanted to report for the compensatory call-in. I've noted that some non-white black individuals have mistaken trauma bonding with whites and white-identified non-whites as friendship. I know I have in the past. Trauma bonding is the toxic bonding between abuser and victim. It parallels Stockholm syndrome, actually post-slavery syndrome. There was an article that I've added here where there was a measurement of how many whites had non-white black friends. Whites have no interest in being friends with you. Whites are only interested in dominating you. Please keep this in mind at all times. Really important, and in my view, related to Robin DiAngelo, because, in fact, I've had listeners who talked about her, and this happens frequently, non-white people talk about her as though she's not racist. The most important thing with any individual classified as white, what did she just say? Whites are only interested in dominating you. Please keep this in mind at all times. People that I hear, non-white people that I hear, they do not talk about Robin DiAngelo as though she is interested in dominating, maintaining the system of white supremacy. Second thing be shared. During the horror days, expect an increase in molestation by whites to non-whites. I think I just said child rapists. Molestation can include sexual advances, emotional dumping, increased psychological, physical, financial terrorism, and many others. Expect to protect your body, mind, spirit year-round. Number three, whites purposely dumb down when talking to non-white people, black people. Here is an article about it attached. Whites know what they are doing at all times. Number four, whites commonly use racial triangulation. Racial triangulation is where the white or white identified, let's try this again. Racial triangulation is where the white or white identified individual, terrorism and hostility between non-whites. I was informed by an individual about the show called The Community. When I saw an episode, I was disgusted at the amount of racist terrorism that was used as so-called comedy. I will place a link below. The link illustrates how an Asian male calls black people dirty, ghetto, using the Spanish language, and how it is permissible because Asians are considered minorities, as the Asian male proceeds to say that none of his friends are dirty, coded language, quote-unquote dog whistle racism. I do not watch entertainment. All of the races, all of the TV programs practice racism, white supremacy, so this sort of content is nothing we should be surprised or shocked about. You could probably turn on the television randomly at any time of the day, anywhere in the world, and you're going to be looking at racist content. That is the system of racism, white supremacy. Even if you don't recognize that that's what you're looking at, that's what it is. Always. I could be in error. Let's see. Phone lines. Yes. Thank you for your patience. Much obliged to be in Toronto for continuing to get her voice on the air, even when racists have fought so diligently to silence her as well. Folks who dialed in, first few folks with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Henry in Chicago.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. I wanted to comment on the situation, I think that was in New York, where the police tried to take away black mother's child. A couple of weeks ago, there was a similar incident that I had witnessed firsthand. I had to take my daughter to the emergency room. She had a hand injury. And while we were waiting in the emergency area, we heard a commotion, me and the other parents. And we started hearing somebody screaming, stop taking my baby away. And a child, young black male, I think he was around maybe four, screaming, please don't do that to my mommy. And so when we went to the scene, there was a black female, young black female, and apparently there were two white nurses, a white security guard and a black nurse, basically trying to rip away the child from the mother. So apparently everybody in the emergency room, you know, was, you know, wondering, why are you doing this? You know, what's going on? So after the struggle, I guess, one of the nurses basically said, let's stop this, because there were a lot of witnesses there. And so they proceeded to call the police. And what happened was the white security officer blocked the doorway. So she got on the phone, and I believe she called the father and was saying that they're trying to take their child away. So, you know, we were all wondering, like, you know, what's going on here? So apparently the father came, the police came, and they all kind of walked out together. And I'm not sure what happened. But afterwards, one of the security – no, not one of the security guards, but it was a registrar – came and told us that, I guess, apparently the situation happened because they suspected that the child was being abused and they wanted to take the child away. Well, first of all, we were wondering, okay, why are you telling us that? You know, I believe – that person violated, you know, serious HIPAA laws when they said that. So it was a situation where a young black mother was, you know, getting her child trying to get her child taken away. And when I saw that incident the other day, it kind of reminded me of that incident that happened in New York. My situation that happened a couple of weeks ago. And that was, you know, something that, you know, I wanted to bring forth, because I think you correctly said it, Gus. If that was my child, I would probably be dead trying to defend my child. So that's all I have on me in my line.
I'm sorry, you, Melissa, I said that. Mr. Fuller said that too. That happens all along. That is white's favorite activity, tossing black people out, finding some reason to toss black out with child or no. Other folks that we've not heard from.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, guys. This is Droptomania. I'd like to say hi to you and the guests. And I just wanted to make a comment about something that you said about habits that we pick up as children. And it was very, I think it was very important, because as a child, you know, I learned that from, you know, the type of environment I grew up in, that being fat or, you know, being overweight was not attractive. And as a young child, what I ended up doing is I started abusing diet pills. And back when I was younger, they sell over-the-counter diet pills. I can't remember what they were called, but I would take them so I wouldn't end up, I would have this, end up having this, I had a complex about being fat because of what my mother used to constantly always comment on, you know, you don't want to get fat and things like that. So that's very true. Like, those, the habits that you pick up as a child, they can continue on into your adulthood. And so I thought that was very important. Also, the young lady from Canada, she, me and her have been studying the same psychology, narcissistic abuse. I am recovering, and I'm just basically finding out about it. And I think one of the ways that I've been, the segue to finding out about narcissistic abuse, although I have psychology degree, we didn't really focus, you know, you don't focus on it as much. But from the CALS program and learning more about racism, white supremacy, I've been able, it's been like a gateway for me to learn about narcissism, because that's, you know, some of the main characteristics of white supremacy, racism, which is narcissism and psychopathy. And Roz, he talks about that all the time, too. So I wanted to thank her, because a lot of the terms and terminology that she's been, that you just discussed, like triangulation, a lot, I've had a lot of that abuse in my household. I come from that type of abusive household. And just learning about that stuff, I'm kind of learning how to kind of diagnose my issues and trying to get some closure with just dealing with a lot of this stuff on top of racism, white supremacy. And I do blame racism, white supremacy for us acting that way, because a lot of those characteristics that we have as far as the Stockholm Syndrome and all those different I'm kind of lost at words. Those behaviors, we are just mimicking the white supremacist. I wanted to ask you if you have heard of an author named Gavin D. Becker. I just, as a result of doing some research on the narcissism, psychopathy, I heard about this man. He has been on Oprah Winfrey, and he wrote a book called The Gift of Fear, Survival Skills, I think, for Dealing with Violence. I'm not sure if you've heard of that book, but it does have a lot of sections with dealing with violence and workplace racism and just basic survival skills. So I'm not sure if you've read the book, ever thought of having this guy on the show. I would say that I think that some of the things in the book is racism. He was practicing racism, white supremacy, because they used in regards to domestic violence, you know, I hate to use a metaphor, but the poster child for domestic violence is O.J. Simpson, of course. And it kind of put me in the mind of men, not how the men are not looked at as victims. I don't know if that would be, if there's a difference when you're dealing with white supremacist suspects as opposed to victims. I'm not sure. But I'm just wondering if maybe you might want to look into that, or maybe check out, maybe seeing if you can get him as a guest on the show. He's an ex-CIA agent, and he, you know, has some insight as to what we can look for when people are about to commit violence against others. And that's all I have to share with us. And thanks for that.
Much of a lot to Mania. I was not familiar with that text, but I will check. Appreciate to have details. Like workplace racism. Still having a disruption with the broadcast for the folks listening. If you are listening online, it may be better if you dial in with your phone, 641-7140-6493. pound, press *61 if we'd like to participate. Other folks that dial in, if we've not heard from you at all, if you have commentary to share, we'll see.
Yo, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
You seem to be breaking up a little bit there, Mr. Gus.
Yes, sir. My Wi-Fi has been horrible. I suspect racist interference. It cut out.
Okay. Regarding the here, hold on. Let me mute myself 1 second because I gotta close this door. But regarding the hold on. My apologies. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Regarding the young the baby that they ripped out from that mother's arms, I spoke to one of my family members that lives in that area, and ironically, they basically came on the news the next day and said, well, she was at the welfare office, and if in fact the father would have been present in the child's life, she would not have been there. She would not have needed to be there in the first place. And that's that, what you would call tackiness. And, I mean, it's like they treat us, we allow them to treat us worse than stray animals. When you have people like, you know, the football player that went to prison for fighting dogs, or if you shoot a dog or if you mistreat a dog or if you're found that animal cruelty carries a heavier weight than mistreating a young, what you would call like a black child or a melanated person. And I just want to know, like, to the family, to the audience, why do we continue to allow it? And the marching, the protesting, that's not going to work. It hasn't worked. It's been going on since the 60s. And I just wanted to know, I wanted to reach out to the audience and say, what, I mean, when is enough? When is enough enough? And thank you for taking my call. That's I got nothing. Nobody feels me.
Hello, ma'am. Be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I think a large part of it is post-traumatic slave syndrome in the contemporary sense that there's a conditioning to endure suffering, like it's a part of our, a part of who we are. Biologically, socially, mentally, and we are given parameters in which to rebel, especially since, like I would say, especially since 1992, they really did a good job quelling any sort of, like, you know, outright and brazen revolt type tactics or behaviors that we would have. We're caught in the hamster wheel of survival, you know, as well. So when you put all those things together, it creates a situation in which people say, you know what, I'm just trying to keep my head down. I just want to get to work and get home, or I just want to do what looks as though will guarantee my biological survival,
okay,
my basic needs met.
Okay, sister. So if I may interject, what you're saying is perfectly correct. And I actually brought out in the first place right here on this show, on Gus' show, and you said that it's a PTSD type situation, but what you just described was actually a current an ongoing current traumatic stress disorder. That's the CTSD. And we have to recognize it, and we have to really put some thought and some science behind it, because what you're saying is, if you're doing this, if you're going through this every day, it's not post. There's no post. Post means after the fact. But we are in a current traumatic stress disorder, and you are totally correct. Like with the brain, it's like becoming a, like you're basically saying, like it's almost like becoming in our DNA, like because of we're so used to becoming generational. And that's where we have to attack it, because this is a current traumatic stress disorder. It's not post. This is not stopped. So we need to get to solutions to figure out how we can deal with it. At first, acknowledge them, and then we can deal with them. So you right on point, sister. And I apologize for cutting in front of you like that.
Oh, no, not at all. I apologize. I can be a little wordy sometimes. Well, I'm glad we have some consensus. May I share this? Oh, are you done, sir?
No, no, I'm listening to you. Shoot, I'm enjoying you. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, sister.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you, Gus, for the broadcast tonight. Thank you to the listeners and the callers. Going to make this fast. The River to Sea comment I found to be akin to an archived session you had with some guy that has a website called The White Call, where a caller had to confront him and ask him if he thought comedy sketches or comedy routines where white people have said the word nigger or nigga was the same as Paula Deen calling a black man a nigga on the phone, and that being brought up in court, and how he used that to subvert away from Paula Deen's track record of racist behavior as an employer. The next thing is traumatized people. Something about kids in school, I'm sorry, I can't remember exactly what it was, but I wrote it down because when I was teaching in a school district after I moved to Illinois for a while after the storm, Hurricane Katrina. There was a young man, he was first grade or second grade, he was having tantrums in class, and they called the parents, and the grandmother was more involved than the mom, and the mom was more involved than the father, who had just gotten out of greater confinement, and the white teacher, female, pretty standard, she goes, you know, I told them they should just put them on pills, you know, all this would be solved if they would just put them on medicine. And I remember telling her, ma'am, medicine can't cure a bad life. And that's something that black, non-white black people have been given as, I would say, from the start, bad lives one way or another, having to deal with trauma. And then the next thing is saving face. So even with video evidence, eye and ear witnesses in a mall, there's going to be a requirement of a 60-day investigation in which everything is basically cut and dry. And that is cold to me, that we are trying to find a way to limit liability or limit the damages that are going to have to be paid out to this family of this man who died, who was murdered by the police. The same goes for Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump supporting a bill, you know, for felons. You know, they're saving face. They're trying to distance themselves and look like they're maintaining some type of control and decorum in the midst of white supremacy, political confusion. And I would also suggest to everybody on the line that if there is such a bill passed, that whites will be the first people to benefit from any judicial or legislative reform, and non-white people get the trickle down of whatever's left. it's not for us. And there are going to probably be non-white black people that say, oh, this is great for black people, et cetera, but they're confused. Moving on, public aid offices, in my opinion, from my experience, as well as, observation, are purposefully outfitted to be uncomfortable, inconvenient, and overcrowded to discourage the claimants to leave before they're seen. I've seen situations where there were no chairs, the facilities were dirty, there were no restrooms, there are signs that says no cell phone use. As soon as you come in, there are security guards, which raises a person's anxiety as it is. These people are there, they need help, and yet the first person that greets them is some type of a correctional officer or security officer of sorts. The process is slow, inconsistent by the employees, many of whom are non-white, but look down at other non-white people needing help as being scum for, I don't have another way to phrase it. There was a caseworker in our presence. One time I was laid off. I needed some help just with food stamps for a little while so I could get another temp job, and we needed to use the bathroom. I said, can we use the bathroom? Other people asked. She's like, no, you can't use the bathroom in here. And she said, quote, we don't know what y'all got. So my advice to anybody that does find themselves needing help, go to the bathroom first, go early, mute your phone, don't let them see you using it, have your papers filled out already and copied. And if you need to, make triplicate originals, have three originals, know your caseworker's name and number, ask for a card, and be diligent and be patient and ask as many questions as possible when you do get seen. And that is very unfortunate that that happened to that lady. It should not have happened at all, but we're still in slavery, and I'm not surprised. I'll mute my line.
Yes, not surprised.
Hang on one second, sir.
Yes, sir.
People that we've not heard from at all. If you have commentary, save face is a metaphor, as is trickle down. Others that we've not heard from at all.
Sorry about that, Gus.
Hello.
No apologies. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Glad you were able to get the system back. I don't know where you went. We're glad you're back. Good evening to everyone. Great. Well, from what I heard, good clips. Like you said, there was problems with the internet. Just, I guess, a couple of things. Always, well, I don't have children, but I know people have children, and my cousin just had a baby. When you have children, especially non-white black children, know the rules. Even though I think their child is only maybe 2 or 3 weeks old, because I'm going to go Tuesday to see them and my father, but to advise you to know the rules of where you have to take your children, especially school. A lot of times they want to discipline the children. Why are you disciplining the children? What are the standards? Because you may teach your kid one way, and in school they may have to act another way. And not everyone can take their kid out and homeschool them. And whether you homeschool them or not, you're paying taxes, and they may abuse the other black children that are not yours. And we don't want them to be abused either, even though they may not be your children. So if you can know those rules, I know if you're an educator, especially in the public school system, and you're able to find those rules, make them available to other black people, that would be nice so that they can prepare their black children for when they enter even preschool. I know in kindergarten they like to negatively discipline. There was one clip where a white man, asked a black man, well, did you know they're doing this in the schools, blah, blah, blah. I think that shows, again, that white people always know more than us. Because he was like, no, I didn't know that, and that's a bad idea. Of course, it's a bad idea. The white man knew it was a bad idea. It was like, oh, did you know? Almost casually. Well, did you know? Blah, blah, blah. It was very casual to them. about Mark Lamont Hill, like you said, VGQ. And I think, I guess because I remember him saying negative things about Dr. Wilson when she passed away. And sometimes your personal feelings about someone, I don't even know her, but she seemed to have a lot of love for black people. And when people say negative things about that, you have to be careful. I guess almost to have a personal, professional opinion. He is still black. He is still a victim. And, yes, he said what he said, and I do believe he was, you know, what may seem to be unjustly terminated based on certain standards. But, you know, you have to be, sometimes you have to move your personal feelings out the way because of the global problems and, you know, be careful and mindful of those things and not let your personal feelings get in the way of what, you know, the professional or the systematic discrimination, racism, terrorism that we receive. And no, I have not read Michelle Obama's book. Hopefully I can get it at the library. Probably be a while now because it's new and it's, you know, very popular. But from what I heard so far, I've seen her do, like, talking about it on C-SPAN is about her whole life, not just being, you know, in the White House. So, I don't know. That's all I have for now. Thank you.
Much obliged. I know Isabel Wilkerson said it deals some with the Great Migration, because that's what she wrote about as well. So that in terms of Michelle Obama's, the whole scope of her time on the planet thus far. Others that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings to callers, listeners, and Gus. Again, thank you for the platform. This is Cujo out of NYC. Well, I don't really want to, well, first I wanted to talk about the mayor of Hoover and the shooting incident or the Shooting Terrorist Act. You know, we hear the conversation so much about diversity, and I even at my plantation, my major global plantation that I work at, they use the terminology about diversity and how diverse we are, and it just sounds so made up and trifling, like they're just again using words to kind of confuse us more and more, as if they really have our best interest in mind, knowing they damn well don't. And all cities across the world are supposedly diverse, but all of them deal with this level of quote-unquote white supremacy racism. They want to try to get out that video footage. I really don't want to see that. I feel like that's just not... We already know what they're trying to do. There was I believe the female caller earlier really summed it up, and I'm just going to phrase it the same way, which is just that they're just looking to find any legal out at this point. They know that they messed up. They're fully aware of it. They're trying to say, what can we do now to recover and make ourselves look somewhat good in the eyes of the so-called public? And that's pretty much all it stands for. The Prince County officers, I can only probably imagine how many officers around this country that deal with the same issue, but these are pretty much one of the few ones that are actually standing up and literally saying something about it. I think it's very interesting, and I'm kind of curious to hear, I have other non-white males that work in the police department here in NYC, and I'm kind of curious to hear their perspective on this case, because I think that this case may lead to other cases being filed as well, but I mean, we will see. Mark Lamont, Mr. Hill, VGQ, he said what he said, and I think that anytime you're having a discussion in regards to Israel, in regards to Jewish people, You have to be very tactful. You have to be very careful because they have been known and will be known to shut you down. You know, I don't know what he's going to do from here on in. I don't know how he'll function because as it stands now, he's anti-Semitic, and that will, especially in places like New York City, basing, you know, like where the media is so powerful, that could destroy him as a whole if he doesn't figure out ways to work around it. And he is speaking about truth. He is speaking about something that is very important, and I tip my hat to him for that. It is not easy to do that. But unfortunately, they, because we don't control any of the media sources, it's a very difficult position that he's in, that he can't articulate himself and speak about justice. Going to now the story in regards to the non-white female that was caught, that was basically arrested, and the child was pulled away from her. I have the Daily News right in front of me here in New York, and it's the Saturday edition. On the front cover of the page is Kid Vid Mama Drama. That's the title that they used to give this woman, knowing that she's already been basically mistreated, subjugated, because she was sitting on the floor and that was the only issue. But this is the title, Kid Vid Mama Drama. This is what they feed the people here in New York to keep seeing the image of that quote-unquote welfare queen, so to speak. And just as a side note, on the front of the cover as well, on the left side of the cover of this magazine, is a non-white male, and the words below are, he's got big tostones. Just to throw that out there, I don't even know if that even adds up. But the article within this newspaper is, you can tell that they're so well interwoven and connected. I'm not using this in that. I just think they're just so well refined. On this, in this article, in the middle of the page, when you open it up, it's on 4 and 5. On the left hand side is a short article about NYC's finest getting arrested for allowing a drug dealer to get away. So here's where they paraphrase now, and they give an article about how great this NYPD officer was, this detective, because he allowed a drug dealer to get away, and, you know, it was a good thing because the guy wasn't really a bad guy and all this other stuff, right? And it sounds real nice and catchy. And then in the middle, they give the article in regards to the non-white female that was basically attacked. And in the middle of this article, in big bold letters, they have witnesses blame her in the tot pull. Cops point at welfare officers. So nobody's really taking any blame here on this, you know. And at the top of the heading of this is Ma Takes New Heat. They're not even calling her a mother. They're not using that terminology. They're not saying that she is a parent or even attempted parent. She's just, they're calling her Ma and Mama. These are the terms that they're using for her, by the way. I think real deep. But the article, I don't even want to go into it. The headlines and the bullet points that are in it say enough as it is. And they call the officers peacekeepers, by the way. They don't call them police officers. They call them peacekeepers, just to get that across. And on the right-hand side is then now seeking ways to defuse trouble. And now they bring City Hall into it. And City Hall is figuring out new ways to de-escalate issues that are threatening and to figure out how to solve situations like this so it doesn't happen again. I mean, this is just so – and I know we should constantly keep reading the paper and staying on point, and I tend to read a lot of things online rather than grabbing the newspaper, but it's different. Like, this is just – straight trash, and they're putting it out there, and they're constantly putting this type of a propaganda out there in the means in NYC to the means to keep the general public brainwashed, not only white people but non-white people mainly, into thinking that she was at fault for the situation that transpired, and she is not. And that's the whole situation that's going down that's really upsetting about this, is that how is a woman sitting down on the floor threatening to anybody in any environment, no matter where she is? You know, that being said, I'll mute my line. Thank you for your time and energy. Peace.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, Gus. Well, my codification is all police are white. So I don't look for much from them, and I expect them to be trying to yank babies from people's arms, regardless of what color they are. And I believe it was a black cop that was doing it. You know, no one to blame more for public assistance, social services, with all these stupid centers and programs that don't work, than the Democrats, who black people love so much. Bill Clinton signed the bill, passed it. Hillary, and she was the first one, she wasn't even a politician, her and Newt Gingrich wrote the bill that created this whole situation where people have to show up at programs to, I mean, just think of how stupid this sounds. You have to go to this program and sit there for 8 hours a day to do job training, but they're not funding the job training, so there is no job training. You just don't sit at a desk or something. While they're going to pay for your kid to be babysat by someone else while you're doing it. Like, this is just the stupidest system. So this lady's forced to sit on the floor. They pull her, try to yank the baby out of her arm. From what I understand, sometimes these appointments, they said this on the news, they go from 4 to 6 hours of waiting. And they always have more than 50% than the amount of seats they have in these centers. So this is what you have, and this is probably for just for someone to initial a piece of paper or to correct a mistake they made. You know, you have to show up at these appointments. It's sad. I think Trump supporting the bill, even sending Kushner to push it, the bill which would reduce sentences and things of that nature, I thought that was very good. Being that we haven't had a president do anything for us in God knows how long, especially the so-called black president. So even against Republican leadership, he's going to do that. I thought that was very noble of him. I don't know how serious it's going to turn out, but we'll see. Mark Lamont Hill, Bon Voyage is what I say to him. Those Jews who put him there took him off the air. I think the Bible says, thou giveth and thou taketh away. All that white supremacist rhetoric pushed for those Jews all these years. Went on air and publicly denounced Louis Farrakhan. And Louis Farrakhan hadn't even been in the news for years. Like, what is he doing? So-called black academic, black scholar. I wonder who made him that. Using black scholarship, I guess he was using white curriculum. So they call him an anti-Semitic, but those people in Israel, I call it Israel. Those are Germans, Slavs from Germany, Poland, Austria, Hungary, etc. Those are not no Semites. Those are white people. And I think him even holding on to faith that he'll get another job from them, because he hasn't come out and said anything against them yet. So I'm glad to see him go. Just like Donna Brazile, I hope we get Don Lemon next. We don't need black people on the news promoting white supremacist propaganda. And he risked his job to speak up for the Palestinians, but never once has he risked his job on CNN to speak up for black people. I can't remember it. So that's all I have to say, Gus. Thank you.
Hope Don Lemon is on CNN for a long, long time. Long live Don Lemon. Long live Don Lemon. Others that we've not heard from. I did want to, the black female who called in, who shared about her, personal, I guess, feelings about Mark Lamont Hill because of, I guess, whatever views he shared about Dr. Welsing, and her not thinking that he's still a victim of racism, white supremacy. I do think that that is important, because I think that there will probably be many times, many instances where there will be an individual that we are not necessarily fond of, so to speak. Maybe we don't have the same views on racism, white supremacy. Maybe they stole, you know, Brussels sprouts from us, anything, who knows. For whatever reason, not someone that we necessarily enjoy their company or what they have to say. That doesn't necessarily mean that they are no longer a victim of racism, white supremacy. That's just important. It doesn't mean that you have to go out and rally for them. It doesn't mean that you have to contribute to their, you know, campaign for governor. Just they are still a victim of white supremacy, even if I find them to be unpleasant.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. I never said he wasn't a victim. I said you have to be able to distinguish between your personal feelings and the professional situation that's going on, that he has been victimized in this professional situation. Never said he wasn't a victim. I know.
Oh, okay.
I'm not confused
right
about that. He is a
right
victim.
On. Important distinction. Important distinction. Important distinction. Yes, ma'am. But important nonetheless, important nonetheless, personal feelings can, you know, sometimes cause us to not be as logical as we should.
And that's why you should be careful of that. Look at the whole situation, you know. And he has at times, I have heard at times on CNN, him speak for black people. But, you know, they really don't care that much about that. So he said we had to say about black people, they try to dismiss them, and they kept it moving. It just wasn't as national as in the UN and things like that.
Others that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hello, Gus. Hello to all of the listeners. This is V from Central New York. It's been far too long since I've been able to take in a live show. And as an additional note, I am making a contribution this week to the show after having to miss, unfortunately, the month of November to take care of some business unforeseen at the time, but business nonetheless. That said, a brief comment. Gus, it was you who used to constantly speak about the need for us as non-white, so-called black people, to have compassion and patience with other non-white and so-called black people, particularly those, those who we should be calling victims of this horrible system. And unfortunately, my evolution around that concept wasn't as quickly occurring as I would like to state. But after about 2 years of really pushing, I believe that's a metaphor, but determining myself towards that particular goal, to step outside of wanting to criticize non-white black people and to empathize with them. After 2 years of doing that, what I have come to see is people such as Mark Lamont Hill, who undoubtedly you can see it literally on his face, is a victim of intellectual abuse within the system that he has to work every single day. I'm keeping it within racism, white supremacy, but that structure, that corporation, he is a victim constantly, and you can see it on his face, that he is a captive almost, which I don't know if that would be counted as a metaphor, but of that thinking. You used to quote, I think it was Louis Farrakhan, who said that the that college is the killing field, if I'm getting that correctly. And you can see this on many of our most intellectually rich peoples who are hired to be commentators for us. And so when I see him, Mr. Hill, I see somebody who is victimized to the point of incoherence. He doesn't understand often how victimized he is. The same goes with Mr. Obama. Mr. Obama was a victim from the moment he started out into the world, and him as president was one long abuse. I think we as black people, we really have to understand the amount of victimization we are under, that oftentimes it constricts us. It doesn't even enable us to see the other black person as a representation. I was going to say the representation of us, but it's not that. It doesn't allow us to see the other person as a victim. We understand that we are victims, but we don't see it in other people. So that is really something that is important to me. Secondly, about the technological issues that you are having, there has been over the course of maybe 3 or 4 months several articles written on the attempts by Google and by the subsidiaries of Google, YouTube, Instagram, and then Facebook, which is not a subsidiary of YouTube, but the larger tech companies, to conspire with the communication company to limit the accessibility to things, whether they are podcasts, whether they are videos, whether they are articles, that they deem radicalizing. And so when your show may be a target of this because you are doing constructive work. It is impossible for anyone to state otherwise. So I hope everybody who's listening will support you and will share it and will distribute it, because as we push forward, we really need programming like this. So thank you for the time that you have allowed me. And keep up the great work.
Much obliged. V in New York. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I was hearing some people, they were leaving Facebook and Twitter and going to Instagram as though. Anyway, other folks we've not heard from at all.
Can I be heard? People.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. I wanted to speak about, in general, white supremacy is still our problem. There's still white supremacy. And we're at the end of 2018. Have we done everything that we could to get along with white people? Have we figured out, have we done everything possible to get along with white people? That's my question, because it's time to figure out what we're going to do with white people. Thank you.
What do you mean when you say to get along? Or am I hearing it correctly? Did you say to get along with white people?
Yes, sir. My thoughts are a little scattered. I haven't spoken in the best way I could have spoken. But
Okay.
Me and Mr. Fuller had spoken before, and he said that, or he had mentioned in one of his broadcasts that we should do everything possible to get along with white people, and we should pick a period of time to do that. And my question is more rhetorical. Well, I don't even know if it's – no, it's not rhetorical. It's real. Have we done everything that we could to get along with white people? Or, you know, or how do we even figure out what that even means?
That's why if I heard Mr. – especially if it's in the book, I think you said you were talking to him, but if it was in the book, like, whoa, I would have to call him, like, tomorrow and be like, what do you mean – get along with white people, because that's not very like distinct. That's not very explicit in terms of, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't even know what that means to even answer that one. What was the other question? Have we done everything that we can to get along with white people? And
well, that was my question, and we're at the end of 2018, and,
right. You
know, are we going to make a decision on what are we going to do? Because at least Mr. Fuller was saying that we could make a decision if we could be on the earth with white people or if we can't be on the earth with white people. But there was something that we were supposed to do, and I think he said we were supposed to try to get along with white people.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. If you could hang on one second.
Sir.
Just let me make sure that we got everybody who hasn't shared. And then if you want to answer that question or if you just have other commentary, we will hear from you. So we got your question. I guess folks will respond. Was that all you wanted to share, Imhan DC?
Yes, sir.
Much obliged. I know we did not. Other folks that we've missed, that we've not heard from at all.
Am I coming in?
Heard both of you. We'll nab our female caller first.
Well, thank you so much. It's caller from the 712 here. And when white people deal with children, so not even bringing the black children in, dealing with how they dealt with their children. You can use an up-to-date example with all the child raping and everything that's going on with children, how it was allowed for the young children to get gunned down and at that daycare or the school, and then we continue on with the bullets flying, so we don't care if the children get gunned down. I was reading about child labor back in the day, and so I didn't really know that it was that extent to, I mean, children going and working like 8-hour days, and they're tired and their limbs are getting cut off, and these are white children, future racist suspects, or they might have been just racist right then as being children working, but they just don't care about children, whether it be white children or non-white children. And I agree with you 100%, Gus. There is no care for the children, and they're doing it because they just don't want to do it. We're being prevented to take 100% care of our children, but white people are doing it just because they don't like children. And so that's that. And then with the school lunches, and that's interesting that's in Seattle where they found all of that, and Seattle is a mostly white area. So again, white people don't care about children. And I had something else to say. Mr. Gus, I try to email you and I never get a response, so I don't know if I'm emailing the right person, but I seen on your wish list, on your Amazon wish list, that you want that rice that has a red flower on it, and so I seen that rice somewhere, and I wanted to send you that rice from the store where I seen it at, because it's considerably cheaper than Amazon, and I don't know if you still eat that rice, but I'm going to try to email you again, and maybe I can get an address to send you, like, some bags of that rice that I think you might still eat, but I don't know. And, okay, that's all I had to say for now, and thank you so much for everybody listening.
Much obliged. UntilJustice@gmail.com. That's such a peculiar inquiry that I don't think I've received that email. I think I would have remembered a rice inquiry because that's such an oddity. So UntilJustice@gmail.com. Retired firefighter, thank you for your patience, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings, everyone. Just two reports that I can think of. I thought was significant was for the first time that I know about as far as following with the Heisman Trophy, all three top candidates were non-white black males, and all of them were quarterbacks, which is the most significant leadership position of the players traditionally in that particular sport. I don't think it is a place of improvement of any type. It's just a matter of how, with the advent of placing the best athletes in a particular professional sport, not a professional sport, but in sports period, and eventually will be in professional, on a professional level, that it demands that the best possible players are recognized from that standpoint, not necessarily from a standpoint of where someone is trying to improve the relationship between non-white black people and that particular profession, which is in this case college sports, and in turn also the NFL. The way things go in the sport of football, as you have superior athletes athletically on one side of the game, you have to have an equal match to be able to compete. And that's primarily the reason why black males are now seizing the top persons at all of the positions on the football field, including the offensive line, to be able to divert away the superior defensive lineman, you have to have an equal match to be able to stop that. And I would say the same thing with the position of quarterback. You just can't stand and throw the football. You have to be able to have other plans if that's not available for you to do so. So that's why the game has changed from that standpoint. I know it's not an interest of a lot of people on this line, but that is the place where a lot of non-white black males are. That's why I've always placed myself there. Other than that, DCS program activity of the day, there was actually a choice as far as a field trip to go somewhere that was kind of like really of no seriousness at all. It's some kind of rumple room type of situation where they just jump around on something. I really don't know the name of it, anything like that. And the other choice was to go to greater confinement. And Mr. Clark chose to go to an area of greater confinement. In this case, it was something that was connected with that industry that's called boot camp, to whereas basically it was people who young people who were placed in a position to where they were getting some sort of opportunity to be able to not have to do long periods of time. I heard something. Anyway, I can hear something in the background. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. That they can avoid to do long periods of time in prison, and if they basically go through this boot camp particular program, and they spoke with the it wasn't one of these scared straight type of things. I'm still factoring in on whether or not it was the most constructive field trip, but it one thing that I thought was interesting was one of the quote unquote inmates that did speak to the younger black males was actually a black female. It was a black female that was in the program. She was the only female in the program. It was a black female. She was asked, would you mind to let them know on what you are in here for? And it was premeditated murder. I'm pretty sure, and one of the guards that was talking to us saying that he's pretty sure that she wasn't really the person who really pulled the trigger and whatever. But you know how that is with law. If you are in that particular group, then they would associate you with the crime also. And she was given a chance to go through this program, and she basically gave some helpful hints to these young black males about you really don't want to come to this level of confinement at all. So while you have the chance, make good decisions, make better decisions than what I made. But like I said, I'm still processing in the entire trip itself to see whether or not did it make was it the best possible place that we could be at with a group of black males. And that's all I have to report for today. Thank you.
That is interesting. I can understand why you would have thoughts about, is that the most constructive investment of our time? Is this the best place for us to visit? Other folks who dialed in, anyone that we missed completely have a hand up? We got everybody? Nobody that has a hand up that we've not heard from at all?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I just wanted to make a few comments, especially with the Mark Lamont Hill victim. He was fired at CNN, and I was thinking of the hypocrisy of, I know Minister Farrakhan was mentioned, and I noticed that they were attacking him and still are, and the black female, I think, that came up with one of the women's movements, and they tried to get her to disassociate with the minister. That was using that same thing about anti-Semitism, but all of the young high school students doing a Nazi salute, Richard Spencer and Donald Trump saying that he's a nationalist and didn't even know what white nationalism was, and people saying that he should denounce white nationalism. But I don't see that same focus on that. And as well, there was a non-white, I don't think she would be classified as black. The actress was accusing of, I think, a white person of sexually assaulting her when she was 17. And it was two white people that came out saying, One said, one thing that a woman doesn't lie about, a woman, it may not be accurate, but she said one thing a woman will lie about is what she ate for lunch, and what they won't lie about is rape. So she was basically discrediting the non-white person's the situation she brought up with the white person that raped her. But when it came to Bill Cosby, she was one of the people out there pretty much saying that he was guilty. My next one is, there was a report on the news about the royal, I guess, pretty much she's still a victim, Meghan Markle, and she was wearing a black dress, and it was a big issue with her nail, her nail polish color or whatever, and it was reported that the queen saw dark colors, exactly, dark colors on her finger. Her fingers is vulgar. The word vulgar was used if you wear dark colors, if you wear a dark color on your fingernail. You know, so I found that interesting. And my last one is, there was a report about dancers in the NBA talking about sexual assault and saying that they were told to do a jiggle test for the players, and they were criticized about their body. So I think that was a slick attempt to criminalize black males and make them the primary epitome of people who are engaged in trying to rape females, of course. So as Gus says, black misandry, another example of that. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
The Man Knot, Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I think we have about 3 sessions left, maybe 4. Dr. Tommy J. Curry, main theme, black misandry in his book, is the black rapist. Oversexed black males got all that testosterone, especially these black athletes. I mean, they do all that running up and down the court and got all those white cheerleaders. Most of the cheerleaders that they have don't look like, I was thinking Beyonce at first, or Gabrielle Union, or Lupita Nyong'o. Most of the cheerleaders that they have, white women, like, oh my goodness, that's whole theme right there. The Man Knot, Dr. Tommy J. Curry. We'll be back Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I did want to get in quickly. You can compare. I said comparison, contrast. That can be an important way to learn at times. You can take the incident that happened this week, Miss Headley in New York, black mother, had her one-year-old offspring snatched from her arms by the NYPD peace officers, as they were called. I think it was last week. We had the audio segment where they were talking about, as a result of what they call the opioid epidemic, all and whites in particular having all this heroin, and fentanyl, and wilding out. And they said, we're going to work because of this. We're going to work to have more programs where mothers can be with their child, even in prison. Remember that, played that segment last week, and they had it set up so that the mom and baby could be together. They realized that that's so important. It's so critical. And just because we got these crackhead white moms can't put the heroin pipe down, we can't have them separated from their child. Remember that? Or maybe you don't, but that was in the audio segment. I think it was last week. If it wasn't last week, it was within the last 2 weeks. And even if you don't hear that segment specifically, there are lots of programs like that where, again, they're not treating white women even poorly. That's when they are really being deceitful with words. They'll say, oh, they won't say it's racism. They'll say it's a problem of class. You know, you got a lot of poor white people that are mistreated, too. They don't treat poor crackhead white moms the way that they treat, really, the way that they treat Michelle Obama. That's racism, white supremacy. But real important comparison contrast, how they treat these white moms even in prison. They keep them with their little racist-to-be children. Black mother just trying to get a voucher, and she could have died, as I said, or the infant could have died. Did we get everybody? Anybody that we missed totally? Grant. I will assume he got everyone. The male caller, we heard from him before. You have the unfortunate habit of referencing me as brother, although I don't think you did it today, thankfully. You were going to respond.
Hold on, Mr. Gus. I've learned my lesson, sir. And
bravo.
I just had a couple of points to touch on. As far as the when the baby was being snatched from the mother's arms, and like I say, my brother, okay, the person I know in that area said that, well, he is my brother, so said basically that they said, well, if the father was there in the baby's life, then maybe she wouldn't have to be there. And, you know, that infuriated me. Like, maybe if she was not there, she wouldn't have to be there if the father was in the baby's life. Okay, well, you know what? That's so hypocritical, and it's such a slap in the face. And another sister called in and said, and then she was speaking, and I'm like, you know what? What about solutions? Because what we do is we call, we report the news, we report what's going on, but solutions. Why was she there in the first place? It's not about the absent father. It's about because maybe we need to come together and figure out how to become more, not necessarily independent, but more empowered. We can't empower ourselves through elections or the churches, paying your tithes, all those things will never empower. It's never worked. But we should start speaking of how can we come together. We're all over this country. We're all over this land, and I think that if we were to come to some type of solution-based dialect, then or dialogue, I should say, maybe we can figure out why we don't have to. We don't need to go to their welfare office or their. We have so many talented. Resourceful people that calls in on this show, and we all deal with other shows. I think we should just try to move more towards a solution base. Instead of reporting the bad, let's try to figure out the good, and let's come together and try to come to a solution-based dialect. And I'll keep it there for now. And thank you for taking my call. Mr. Gus.
Mr. isn't even needed. Gus is totally fine. Much obliged, sir. My view would be if, and I certainly salute people who talk about, you know, let's not just report things to whine about, you know, let's try to focus on things that we can do. Because there are things that we can do that would help towards solving this problem. Hopefully some of those are offered on this platform, the context of white supremacy. I would caution against using the term come together. In my view, that's close to a metaphor. It's certainly not distinct. Even if it's not a metaphor, it's not explicit in terms of what that means, who exactly. Same thing almost with the earlier caller, get along with white people. It's certainly not like specific. It's not a lot of detail in terms of what we mean when we say come together, which is said frequently. It's almost, it is cliche. With the specific incident with Miss Headley, this black mother, I think she was there for a voucher for childcare of some sort. So if that's the specific problem that we would be trying to find a solution for in this incident, I mean, that seems to be a widespread problem across the globe, not just in this part of the world. Here specifically, but lots of places in terms of getting child care. I mean, it can be expensive. It can be difficult because lots of people have to work or they have different time commitments. So that can be a struggle. And I think in the system of racism, white supremacy, racists, they require us to use a lot of our time supporting the system of white supremacy. So it is the case that you have a lot of black people that just wouldn't be able to do that. I can see how that would end up being a very challenging problem. Goes back to why Dr. Welsing and many others say there should be a lot of thought about having children, because, man, that is going to be, racists have already designed it. That is going to be a very challenging proposition for the next 25 years, if not longer. Unless I, and again, I don't have children. Maybe I'm speaking out of turn. Any parents want to step up? Maybe I'm talking crazy. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to say this about this Headley. What was reported the day after as well, or maybe a couple days after, because she went to the prison or went to jail and was held, I think, for a day or two. However, they said that the police officers will not be charged, but the security for the welfare office, I believe they were either suspended or fired. And the police, not the commissioner, it was the guy, the union representative, he was on the news saying, you know, they were reckless, they shouldn't have called the police for this type of instance. We only know how to report to things one way. And we handled it the way we were trained to handle it. And, you know, if they would have called us, we wouldn't have had this problem. So they pretty much, metaphor. They pretty much just let the security take the brunt of the force for the issue. To Imhon DC's question, I remember speaking to Imhon DC before. And I believe that the context in which he asked Mr. Fuller something to the effect of, can we solve this problem? You know, he gave a specific amount of time. And Mr. Fuller, what things should be happening before we solve this problem? Something to that effect that he said, we've, tried everything to get along with white people and it hasn't worked, to the effect of not getting... then we can try to solve the problem. So I think what he was asking was, have we tried everything, which I agree with. We have tried everything to get along with them, and it still hasn't worked. So maybe we need to change the way that we're trying to solve this problem, because we've tried everything. We tried to get along with them, and they are just unable to get along with anyone. And I'll meet my line, Gusty.
Much obliged. Did any of the parents specifically want to speak to the point about child care? Because my understanding, that is pretty challenging, and I'm not sure that that's something that under a system of white supremacy, that black people, that's one that can be easily remedied, because it would have been taken care of already. Any parents want to speak to that?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
One alternative, and I'm not saying that it's going to be a perfect answer with that, with what I'm about to say, but I do know the YWCA offers daycare vouchers instead of going through a state public aid office. They do that for women who are either enrolled in school full-time or women who have jobs, either part-time or full-time.
Okay. That's a great resource to share. I was even thinking, people can look at that, and I know some people who have what they call entrepreneurial way of thinking will say, hey, maybe more black people who have an interest, if you enjoy or are talented working with children, maybe more black people should look into opening up daycares and that sort of thing to be a resource for black parents. Fantastic. Great. System of racism, white supremacy, they do have business licenses, and generally they require licenses if you're going to have some sort of daycare business where you have children. You know, we don't want any old molester, so they'll say, to open up a daycare center. So that's going to require directly, indirectly, white people giving you permission, authorization to do this, which can be revoked when they feel like it. So, you know, any other parents want to speak to this before we?
I'm sorry, Gus.
You were going to say something?
I just wanted to address something to the retired firefighter and the gentleman that asked about if we got along, have we done everything. I do know, real quick, I'm looking into a group, the BAIO, the Black African Infrastructure Organization. It's a group of black or non-white black people who are investigating the feasibility of leaving America. I'm getting to the point where I'm about ready to go. I'm not saying that it's going to be, you know, perfect or anything. It may be something for us to look into, excursion. I don't know. The other thing to the retired firefighter, I don't know if you've seen this, but there is a push to absolutely make synonymous the NFL with the military. There are jerseys being sold that are in camouflage and have the same tailoring as what we call camos or camouflage with the name tapes. But instead of it saying, for instance, a last name, U.S. Marines or U.S. Army, it says the city, and then it says the team name. So, for instance, New Orleans on the left, and then Saints on the right, where the person's name would go on the name tape on the camouflage. And thank you. Good night, everybody. Thank you, Gus.
Much obliged. That is important programming. They'll say we got autonomous robots. They'll be capable of cooking the sloppy joes for the school lunches and driving the recycling trucks and garbage trucks and the buses and everything else. They already got the Amazon. So I just told you they got that in Seattle. They got the Amazon store. There are no people in the store at all. You just go in and buy whatever you're going to buy. We don't even need people for that. So, yeah, we won't have anything to do. So, yeah, you can sign up and be Army Strong. Hashtag. Got that job for you. Get prepared. Get, as I said, young patterns got a whole lot of very young children, especially young boys spend a lot, and they even do increasing marketing of NFL to young girls as well. But get lots of young boys watching that at a young age, conditioning their thinking. Yeah, that's what to do. Army Strong. Yeah, that's the ticket. Forgive the metaphor. That's what I should do with my time and energy. Be Army Strong or Navy or whatever else. Anyway, we did our 3 hours. Much obliged. If you have gripes, questions, complaints, email untiljustice@gmail.com. It is the holiday season. I would just encourage self-care. I know for a lot of people, I know for myself, this is the second year. This week, it's been a year since the flood, a year. I would have gone crazy if you had told me this time last year, an entire 365 days will pass and you'll be in the exact same spot almost. Woo! I would have had a breakdown if you had told me that last December, last January, last February. Woo! Anyway, a whole year of racial dislocation to deal with. And you just try to do the best you can, self-care. This is two consecutive Decembers that I have been in downtown Seattle, and they have all of the Space Needle has Christmas lights on it now, and they have all of that nonsense up. And, I mean, it's intense being around all of that. So I know we have a lot of people in the New York City area, and they're in other major cities, or just wherever you happen to be at, period, and you're being bombarded with all of that. That can take a toll on you. And then all the, if you have to be out and around malls and all that nonsense, and then the it can just be very tough on people for a variety of reasons. It could be extra stress on your job. It could mean people having to work more hours. I know we've had listeners, Rob in Wisconsin, among others, said them having to work more hours. They couldn't even participate in the program. Self-care. And that does not mean alcohol. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. They played a Well, they didn't play. They had a report they were talking about this time of year specifically with the holidays. It's darker. You don't have as many daylight hours. That has a big impact on our health, well-being, just how we think, how we feel. And they were saying that one thing, one suggestion, reduce, minimize alcohol consumption, because it does not help in this particular time of year, and it's so promoted. Let's watch the game and drink a few. We're going to have our office party and drink a few, open bar and all that nonsense. Sobriety would be best. Let's minimize any potential to compromise our brain computer under conditions of white terrorism. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up each and every time we are in a vehicle, driver or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Oh, we'll be here tomorrow. Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. Back on schedule. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.